client for you. So we'll talk later.
Yes, we'll talk about later, not here.
Yeah.
All right. I'm going to open the House Committee on Agriculture, Interim Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. It's 9/22/2011. And I'm going to open and... So this is our organizational meeting, this first part is. All right, so I'm going to open a work session on generally.
Mr. Chair, I move we adopt the rules.
Representative Schaffler moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated 9/22/2011. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, the motion passes. The rules are adopted. Close the work session. That's not on my script. I don't know what to do. I'm paralyzed with fear right now.
You're in organizational meeting, so you're fine. You can
all right. Okay. So I'll close the work session. Getting a little rusty around here.
We can recap our summary.
Yeah. So, yeah, our fellow co-chair, who actually sort of brought this next one to our attention, is still a few minutes away. We don't have new committee members, so I don't really know that we need to go through and introduce ourselves, but if you have any updates over the last few months you want to share, you can. Otherwise, we'll just go into the informational meeting.
Who's on the phone?
And we'll call somebody, too.
Two people.
We'll call two people right now.
Hello, this is Jake Hickman at USDA APHIS.
Okay, perfect. We're just going to put you on hold and connect one more person. Thank you.
Great, thank you.
How's the weather been on the coast?
It's quite glorious.
Mm-hmm, yeah, good and bad. Very bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah. My garden is just...
So you can call
me. Yeah. My daughter was playing with my...
September and October.
Okay, perfect. I'm just going to connect you to the conference call. Thank you.
Heart is like this.
All right, so I'm going to open our informational meeting and ask Don Hansen to join us.
Okay, perfect. I'm just going to connect you to the conference call. Thank you.
So if you can put your phones on mute, and if you're watching it on the computer, if you could turn that volume down, that would also thank you.
Okay, so we're just done by himself. It's Dr. Hansen, welcome to the committee. Sorry, our logistics are
thank you.
Slightly
thank
off.
You. Good morning, co-chair and vice chairs and fellow committee members. I'm Don Hansen, for the record. I'm state veterinarian from the Department of Agriculture. I've been asked to come here this morning and give a background, just a little talk on horses in general in our state, and then bring up the issue and start the discussion on abandonment. So just some background. According to the 2007 census, which is the last one we've got, there are approximately 89,000 horses in our state. The majority of those probably owned and retained by large cattle ranches in the eastern part of the state, at least when horses are collected by numbers. And then the other piece of information is the cost of maintaining a horse. Not purchase, that's all separate, but just to maintain, to feed a horse typically costs about $3,000 a year in just hay. And if that horse is exercised and needs supplemental feed, you can certainly add more dollars on top of that. Now, horses need to be shod, so that's another $1,000. Horses need to be protected, so vaccinated, and maybe be tested for specific diseases if they're traveling in and out of the state. So around $4,200, $4,500 per year is a typical cost to keep a horse in your backyard. And if you have your horse housed at a stable facility, then you can add that rent, whatever that is. And part of that's feed, so you could take part, but the other part of it is just maintenance and that. And I don't have good figures for that. So if you have a horse, now we'll move forward. We want to talk about reasons people relinquish ownership in the horses. And there could be several. One, the age of the horse. He's too old, can't play with him anymore. Or the opposite. The person becomes too old or disinterested or moves away, i.e. everyone in the room who has children who grew up with horses, there comes a day when the child goes away and there you are with the horse in the background in the backyard. And so that's I don't want this horse. Then we have horse injuries. severe, of course, that's more of a medical emergency and that's relinquished but maybe euthanized. And then we have horses that are injured but don't fully recover. Maybe they're not in pain, but you recognize, I can't play with this horse anymore. If I ride him a little bit, he gets sore again. And then we have just most currently, but always underlying reasons for relinquishing, is the financial situation of the owner. And recently, we all know, it's been tough. So financial hardship is another. And then the other smaller reason is horse behavior. The horse just becomes incorrigible from the owner's point of view. And see, anyway, they're going to give it up. So the options that we have and can explore for an owner is euthanasia, which, of course, is a humane putting to sleep or putting the horse down. But that involves a veterinarian in the cases that we're talking about, and that's a $200 or $300 bill. And then you have a situation with a very large carcass that needs to be disposed of. And in our state, we have a few companies that will come by and pick up that carcass and take it to either a landfill facility or take it to a drop-off point where a rendering service picks it up. But that's another few hundred dollars for that service. And then we have the option in our state of burial. And at the present time, our agency is looking at the regs or the policy around burial on site. It is an option. There are constraints, obviously, near streams, running waters, wells, depth, the water table, all those things have to play a role in can you do it. But getting to the, so that's one concern, but getting to the other part, that probably involves a very large piece of machinery like a backhoe. You're not going to hand dig that to let that happen, at least not in the places where that I think about. Then you could give it away. That's another option. And in the giveaways, what we're seeing is a rise in what we call horse rescue operations. And those are very valid. They're voluntary. They're privately owned. Serve a tremendous good in our state. And there are several of them. But they have an endpoint capacity. And statistically, they get rid of or turn over in their rescue if they're allowed to. 75% of the horses that are turned in, but then we have this 25% that just never goes away and is adding up, so it's not sustainable doing as a piece. And the giveaway, the other part of possibility is to give away to another person who says, perfect, I want that horse. And then they keep it. Then we move to selling as an option, just straight up, and Craigslist have got plenty, and auction markets. The price for a horse varies tremendously. In private treaty around the state, people can still negotiate a pretty good price, but on a wider scale, the price of horses has really plummeted for all of the reasons we've talked about. There's an excess market, and we're no longer slaughtering for meat, but that's only a small factor. The rest is probably just a supply. But so the price in most markets is infinitesimal. So it's not much of an option, and sometimes it doesn't even get taken up. If you take a horse to auction, sometimes no one bids, and then you're taking the horse back. So we have those, and then we're talking about abandonment. And I have a thought process, because I'm generally a positive person, and I generally think that people are positive too, even though they don't think right, in my opinion. They're misinformed. So I think we have a case of great American denial going on when people abandon their horse. They turn it off believing in their hearts, truly, that the horse is going to be fine. I'm going to turn it out in the forest, and golly, look at all that green, because it's spring. And the horse is going to be fine. The truth is far short of that. Most of the time, horses that have always been in a backyard or a small corral environment really don't know how to forage, and so they don't have a good life. But those are what we're getting to, the abandoned horse scenario. And in our agency, we don't track abandoned horses. That's not reported to us. Local sheriffs probably have a better idea what's going on in their counties of abandoned, because they're the ones who get the call, hey, there's a horse on the road, or there's this and that. So we have an idea. And the horse rescue operations that pick those up, they have an idea. But I don't have a good idea, except I probably would agree with the tendency that we're noticing in the United States and here in the West too, that it's on the rise, that there are more abandoned horses than there have been before. Our statistic has to do with horses that we call astray. We have a statute that says if a horse is astrayed, that is found on a location, we will assist the owner after they've, not the owner, but the person who collects that horse, takes it up, will assist them in selling that horse or finding the owner. And what we've seen is the percentage of horses for which we can find no owner has greatly increased over the past 3 or 4 years, meaning, in my opinion, more falling into this totally abandoned horse. I'm not claiming it. You can't catch me. It's gone. And as well as just the numbers. The number of reports has gone up, but the number of horses for which we have no, can't find an owner, and therefore are sold, has gone up even more dramatically. Probably in 2010, there were 35% of the horses that we were involved with with the astray statute that we found owners. And so far this year, so we're only, you know, this is August, September, and we're not finished with the year, and we already have 30%, so it may be higher this year of non-claimed horses coming up. So that's what that's my brief little picture on horses in kind of where we are. I think we have some speakers coming up, someone on the phone from USDA who can talk to us about perhaps mention the closure of the slaughter facilities in the United States, and then talk to their expertise on the federal law that's involved with the regulation of transporting horses to slaughter. And so I heard Dr. Hageman on the phone. Are you still there?
Good morning, Dr. Hudson. This is Jake Hageman here at USDA APHIS. I'm joined by Dr. Gary Agri, who's the agency's farm animal welfare coordinator. He'll actually give a few comments this morning on transport, as you pointed out.
Go ahead.
Good morning, committee. Thank you for asking us to attend, and we do appreciate that opportunity. Once again, my name is Dr. Gary Agri. I work for United States Department of Agriculture in the agency, the Animal Plant Health Inspection Service. We oversee many things related to animal health issues, and as Dr. Hanson mentioned, there are no slaughter facilities in the United States for horses, but what we do oversee is the commercial transport of horses to slaughter. So our role might be quite limited to the issues that this committee is addressing. However, Dr. Hanson did mention that I might talk about the horse slaughter or the closure of horse slaughters in the United States. That did end back in 2007. The last three slaughter plants were in Texas and Illinois that closed for state reasons, state law. Beyond that, there's another agency that does address the slaughter horse issues, which you might be more directly related or interested in. That would be the Food Safety Inspection Service. So if there are specific questions related to slaughter horses, how that's regulated and the permission to do that in, say, Oregon, we'll have to defer that to the Food Safety Inspection Service. But again, what we address here is just the commercial transport of horses to slaughter in Canada and Mexico at this time, since there are, again, no slaughter horses, no commercial slaughter horses in the United States. So all we do is to ensure that if the horses are going to go to Canada or Mexico, that it's done so in a humane manner. There are certain regulations such as no use of electric prods, no double-decker trailers, and that the conveyance itself needs to be in a condition that wouldn't cause any harm to those animals. And finally, if those animals are given 6 hours of feed, water, and rest prior to being moved in the conveyance. We do have a new regulation that was just published on September 7th of this year that goes into effect on October 7th that says that once an animal is purchased or it was moved with the intent to go to slaughter, any point along its movement to an assembly point, feedlot, or other stockyard, they then fall under our regulations. Currently, what we're doing is enforcing them at their points of embarkation. So as horses are leaving the country, it's either the United States, our agency, mostly if they're going to Mexico, making those inspections, or if they're going to Canada, it's the Canadian Food Inspection Agency is making those inspections for us. So there are certain points that we do ensure that the humane transport, but again, listening to Dr. Hansen, I think we're quite peripheral to the specific issues that you're looking to address. Thank you. I'll be happy to take any questions.
If you've got a few minutes, Doctor, we'll finish the other two folks.
And okay, thank you.
Yeah. So, Shannon, Mr. Shannon Jordray. Oh, on the phone. Sorry. Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hey, good morning. My name is Shannon Jordray. I'm a consumer safety officer in the Division of Compliance at FDA Center for Veterinary Medicine. My specialty is the regulation of animal feed. I guess I didn't realize I was supposed to prepare any remarks, but I'll just say this. Given the direction of the topic here, there's no prohibition on the use of horse meat in pet food. There never has been. In fact, years ago, horse meat was a staple in pet food. The regulations haven't changed in the meantime. FDA doesn't inspect horse slaughter. We inspect pet food manufacturing. But beyond that, I guess I would prefer to answer any questions if you had questions.
I have one question for clarification. Shannon, is it not true that meat from horses going into pet food must be inspected by FSIS, isn't that true?
No.
Oh, I thought it was.
No, we would probably prefer it came from that type of a source, but there's nothing in the law or the regulations that requires that.
No.
Thank you for that clarification. That was a major tape in my head.
Okay, so my question was, after crossing the border, what happens? Is there any assurance that the other countries are doing the same thing? And then this last question just brings up the case if there is the pet food manufactured in the U.S. or in Canada and Mexico, and therefore the slaughter isn't an issue, but if the horses can't be slaughtered in the U.S., how does the company... in the pet food company get the horse meat to make it? Do they have to import it and all that?
See if you can.
Secretary Gary from USDA. I'll answer the first part of your question. So our authority ends at the border. So once those horses cross into Canada or Mexico, we have to rely on the competent authorities in those countries. And for Canada, it would be CFIA, Canadian Food Inspection Agency, and for Canada, it's an agency called SAGARFA. And they give us our assurances that they do have regulations that those horses do need to abide by those regulations during that transportation. But as far as our oversight does end. And I think that's one of the points that people have used to request resumption of Florida United States, because if we have in Florida United States, then we do have oversight of those horses during transport as well as at the slaughter facilities by FSIS.
Yeah. Co-chair Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Coacher. I'm not sure whether that was the answer or answered Representative Boone's question. It doesn't answer a question that I have, though, if I understand that the horse meat or the horses in no way inspected within the boundaries of this country, but if the pet food manufacturers are using horse meat, RE, they must be importing it then from either Canada or Mexico. What, if any, regulations, inspections take place as that commodity comes into this country for use in pet food?
Shannon, do you have a response?
Well, the first hurdle would be APHIS. So, and you guys can come back to that. But you know, if it meets all of the APHIS requirements, you know, in terms of health issues and things like that, similar to beef or pork or any other type of meat product or animal product, then it could come in. Our the FDA's regulations don't permit or don't prohibit the use of imported meat and pet food either. Meat or meat byproducts, I should say.
Dr. Hansen, did yes. you have a observation or comment?
I don't, because it's totally out of any jurisdiction that I even that I have. Our guys at USDA, do you have a comment that you could make? I know that's not in your jurisdiction, but are you aware of what the USDA regulations are for a meat product to cross into the United States?
Yeah. No, I'm not aware of any of those requirements. And certainly, again, the program that we manage is just for the humane transport of horses. It doesn't have anything to do with horse meat for human consumption or pet food.
Can I rephrase my question here?
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me a little bit with what happens as far as beef from Argentina, as an example, coming into this country, not for pet food, but for consumption by the American public. Is there any kind of inspection there other than depending on Argentina?
If it's for human consumption, that would not be an animal plant health inspection service issue. If you're talking about beef from Argentina, you know, there might be issues. I'll use the example of foot and mouth disease, where we have to make sure that those either animals or products come from foot and mouth disease free areas or free farms, but that has to do with animal health and the protection of our agricultural commodities, livestock, from those diseases, not a food safety issue.
Okay. I think this lowly committee in the state of Oregon that's dealing with this topic is treading on grounds that maybe the United States Congress deals with rather than, you know, what we're dealing with. But I am kind of curious about this. I'm reminded, in fact, a year or so ago that I had to spend a lot of time reading labels before I bought dog food because some was coming in from China, as I'm recalling, and dogs were dying all over the country, and my wife happens to be very fondly attached to our dog and wanted to ensure that we didn't have the same kind of results. So we had a little mini boycott of that particular sort of thing. So, but at any rate, you answered, I guess, my questions on this, and it remains for further discussion, maybe in another place, etc.
Mm-hmm. We've got one more speaker. So I'm reading this GAO brief on this topic, and you know what they describe, although there may not have been, I mean, somebody on the phone said there weren't really any regulatory changes per se, but it sounded like in 2006 Congress disallowed any funds to be used for inspection of horses destined for food, so it effectively prohibited domestic slaughter because it's not allowed to be, and no money can be used for inspections. And so it wasn't only state legislatures closing down things, there was also Congress made a decision.
And then, you know, I'm sure it's debatable in many people's mind, but not long after that time, all of a sudden, massive increases all over the place in horses that we're end up having to deal with in counties and states because the normal market method of dealing with it went away. And, you know, so I think that's probably why my co-chair asked about this, because he's hearing about it in his part of the world, and we're obviously seeing upticks. Colorado had a 60% increase in neglect and abuse. The economy certainly hasn't helped, as people can't afford to keep their horses. But, you know, there was a way of dealing with this that changed at some point, obviously, in the relatively recent past. And what the GAO recommended was essentially reconsideration of those restrictions to allow more inspection or... instead, just do a permanent ban on horse slaughter, you know, period. So, anyway, this is an interesting document if any of the committee members want it, but I think this is why we're talking about this right now, because we're feeling it locally, and at least the GAO is attributing it in part to a change by Congress in the use of funds for inspection. And unless there's other people who really feel their brief isn't right, that's all I know about it so far. It's what I've heard today. I've never even thought about this issue, to be honest, before yesterday. And now I'm starting to discover why it's a thorny problem. And I think we have a person here who can talk about slaughtering in general. I certainly know we've had issues losing rendering facilities here in Oregon. And generally speaking, disposing of large animals is becoming a really big issue and a big problem, all at least in Oregon. And so maybe we should move into that part now and ask Jerry Gardner to come on up and tell us what he knows about this issue.
Good morning. For the record, Jerry Gardner, Business Development Manager with the Department of Agriculture. For about the past 3 years, the ODA has been involved with groups of ranchers really from Wallowa County down to Curry County, all of them interested in increasing our capacity to process beef, hogs, lambs here in Oregon. I have a stack of feasibility studies, business plans, and self-help guides that are about a foot tall, representing about $400,000 in various studies that have been done to try to look at this issue. Many of these folks are interested in taking advantage of local demand for their grass-fed, hormone-free, antibiotic-free beef. That's what's kind of driving this. A lot of people took a look at mobile slaughter units, figuring that they could spend $300,000 and send a mobile unit from one farm to the next. But that really, and people are now coming to understand this, needs to be connected with a fixed facility, because you can't just kill them out on the ranch. You need some place to bring them to cut the meat up so you can get up to $1.5 million in quick order. This can't really be done on the cheap. So we have currently in Oregon about 11 USDA slaughter facilities. A couple of those just kill hogs, but they produce on average about 1.5 million pounds of beef per year for sale. Our largest one is in West Eugene, Bar S Packing, does about 300 animals a week. So we're kind of small when you compare what's done in the Midwest with people like Cargill and Tyson, who kills thousands of animals a day. I can kind of be brief here and just, we have about 50 custom cut operations, which are not USDA inspected. They kill animals for specific individuals. That meat cannot be sold to the public. And they also would process wild animal, or, you know, wildlife that's deer and elk that's brought to them. We've struggled over the years here, I think, to find entrepreneurs who want to get in the beef processing business. We'll call a meeting and 40 people will show up, but they're all trying to find a place to get their 5 or 10 animals slaughtered next year. These are not people that want to invest in or run a meat packing plant. So we've looked around really all over the state for that kind of individual. When we find one, we do everything we can to help them get involved in this business. The last one we dealt with, we finished a study here in April 2011 for a company down on coast in Bandon, Mobile Ranch Butchering, working with our friends at USDA Rural Development and Curry County Economic Development. We got a $50,000 grant and brought a fellow in, Dr. Keith DeHaan from Kansas City, to put together the business plan for this operation down on the coast. That plan called for building a 6,100 square foot building on 10 acres. The improvements, equipment, infrastructure improvements, equipment, and working capital brought that total project to $2.6 million. But to take a small custom cut operation and say, if you want to get in this business in any substantial way, that one would have killed about 1,200 beef cows a year, 1,200 hogs, 480 lambs, and about 360 cull cows per year. $2.6 million and trying to get a smaller guy involved in that just can't make it happen. We've had a number of financial institutions look at that. Oregon Business Development Department looked at that. USDA Rural Development looked at that. But it's tough to find an entrepreneur that's willing and financially capable of starting or expanding their meat processing business. If we take, we don't know how much meat is actually consumed in Oregon, but just kind of on the back of a napkin here, we take Oregon's 3.8 million residents, multiply that by the USDA annual consumption, 58 pounds of beef per year. That takes us up to about 220 million pounds of beef probably consumed in Oregon. You divide that by the 1.5 million each of our existing plants produce, we would need 147 more small little plants like the ones we have now in order just to satisfy local demand. So we will be bringing beef in from out of the state for a long time to come in the future. And I guess that's the comments that I would have to make just to get us started here.
Lisa, would you like to join us?
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Agriculture. I think co-chairs, members of the committee, Representative Jensen had a question regarding import, and I am by no means an expert on the federal regulations around import of meat, but we surely can go back and make contact with FDA, who oversees the imports of food products into the states and try and clarify what needs to happen with meat and if there are, what types of meats are being imported. The other thing that I would add anecdotally, I just returned from the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture annual meeting, and this was a topic of conversation there, and it ran pretty deep in terms of the issues across the nation with the abandonment issues, the growing population of horses, and what to do with them. And I think Representative Clem hit on it in the GAO report that just recently came out. I believe it was just a couple weeks ago that report was issued, that when the federal inspection went away, that changed many dynamics, along with the sentiment of this country of the horses being very iconic, and where in some states horse slaughter has been banned. Just to clarify, in Oregon, horse slaughter is not banned. We're challenged from the inspection standpoint and the slaughter capacity standpoint. And then, again, over that then is the symbolism and how horses, I think in many cases, people see them no longer as livestock, but they're treated more like a companion pet in many cases. And so all of these things together create quite a conundrum, I think, that the nation is struggling with, and it's not only Oregon looking at these issues and trying to figure out how to work through them.
It sounded like, you know, at one point, the attitude about, let's turn the other blind eye to what was going on, but people would sell them for food to countries where people like to eat them. People decided they didn't want to have that happening anymore from here, so
we instead ship them to the U.S. or to Canada and Mexico, then they sell them to other people who want to eat them, which is sort of absurd, really. I mean, they're getting eaten by people regardless of whether, you know, we do it from here, but that's the way politics works sometimes. And so the market forces seem to work that when you were going to sell it and eat it somewhere else, the remnant parts you could then make pet food out of, but because now we're not selling them directly to someone to eat them, we're selling them to someone else to sell them to someone to eat them, we've got all these parts that are sitting in Mexico and Canada not coming back here to be used for pet food. So there's no one here to buy these horses at a pretty cheap price where they can at least use it for both the food sales, and it's just the reality of the situation. I like horses too. I don't know how I feel about it, to be honest. I haven't really thought about it that much. But we've got ourselves in a weird situation here because of this illogic that other people like to eat them, and so we're just trans-shipping them, I think we call it. Like they were doing honey this way, we just trans-ship it and then they eat them anyway.
Well, one other comment in the course of traveling around, visiting with different groups, we visited with the Warm Springs Indians, and they started looking at a meat processing facility and mentioned that horse slaughter is something they could be interested in, and they counted 40,000 horses in the Pacific Northwest that need to be slaughtered. And they were going to take a look at the fact that because they're the sovereign nation, they might be able to establish such a facility there outside in Warm Springs. But they did get a $25,000 grant to look into that. But to my knowledge, that has not progressed. But they were at one point thinking about this too.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I like the word illogic. What we got here is a bunch of people living in a concrete jungle that wouldn't know how to slice a tomato, let alone butcher a head of beef. I had the distinct pleasure of working in a packing plant for a year, lugging beef when I was younger, and it ain't pretty. But you know what? I love my steak, and if we're going to import beef in Oregon, it should come from the great state of Iowa, not Argentina. But we have a bunch of policymakers that don't, they're not living in reality. These animals need to be butchered, processed, and dealt with, and that's all there is to it. And we're not living in reality. Got a bunch of people who use toilet paper. They don't want to cut down a tree in this state. It drives me to distraction. And we got to mine gravel too. But thanks for coming. This is very enlightening. And it's legal to butcher a horse in Oregon, though, according to the. But we don't have any way to inspect them. Therefore, it's just quit happening. And now we got all this excess of animals. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Is that what's going on here?
Just a comment about inspection. If we had a plant and they wanted to slaughter horses, that would be legal. If they needed to be inspected, we could investigate a state inspection system, because that were the last three plants that went. They were state plants. So there could be an inspection, but it would be a state inspection, different from the federal, which is goes across borders, etc. Just a minor point.
Thank you.
There were two issues that are associated with us. Rendering is one, Representative Boone, we looked into quite a while ago. But also the state inspection, we took a look at that. We used to have state inspection here in the 70s, but discontinued it at meat processing plants. But we would have to charge fees to do that, something that the USDA is supposed to provide for free. And we're wondering if it would be cost prohibitive for the Department of Ag to get involved in that. We have taken a look at that and done a little study, some work on that as well, that we'd be glad to share.
Just as a sidelight question on that, would that product then be confined to the intra-state commerce rather than interstate? I mean, could we ship that product out of the state?
With respect to beef, co-chair, I know that the National Association of State Departments of Agriculture were looking at expanding the role of states to inspect meat in the state and allow that meat to be sold across state lines. So this is in the works. I'm not exactly sure what the final result of that is right now, but that is that has been thought of before.
As a follow-up, Lisa Hansen, there has been a pilot program that the State Departments of Agriculture have been working with USDA on equivalency of inspection. I think that the challenge becomes the cost of carrying out those services and having the profit and loss meet in a way that it works for businesses, and that's been the challenge around slaughter in this state. I think Jerry touched on that. Is there are many business options out there, but in terms of the risk and the cost involved with all the different facets, of the meat processing situation, it's been very difficult to find willing entrepreneurs that want to invest and move that direction.
Well, and what's the penalty if you get caught letting your horse, abandoning your horse?
I'm not sure that there's a penalty. They could be if we had the horse, we picked, as an agency, we picked it up, and we found you as the owner and could prove you were the owner, then you could be liable for all of those costs of holding the horse, keeping it in confinement until we could turn it back to you.
Okay, I mean, could someone charge you with, could a DA charge you with, I don't know, is there abandonment or cruelty to animals? Or just
there is
out
neglect. And if, again, if you had ownership, then you have the neglect statute that could play a role and say that's neglect, and then they could be charged with animal neglect.
And I guess we got bigger problems for our jail beds, so maybe just making sure they have to pay the whole cost of dealing with the situation is the, you know, the right way to go about it. But, I mean, some level, you shouldn't just buy your horse and when your kid leaves, throw it out in the woods and think it's going to be fine like some Disney movie.
Right.
Well, I think that's what we're living in here, Mr. Chair.
I think they think, shucks, let's just let it run wild all over the place and it'll be fine. And you know.
Crazy. Jesus.
Sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm a little rusty here with my P's and Q's.
And I see we're approaching our timeline on this. I don't want to interrupt any other questions that people may have. So if you have any questions, I'd ask you to ask the chair to get the chair's permission to ask him.
Representative Springer, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, I was waiting for us to transition back to slaughterhouses, but I'm going to jump in now with this. Jerry, you had made the comment, and I'm assuming I misunderstood. I've got to believe I misunderstood. You said there's approximately 50 local slaughterhouses in the state. I had to have heard that wrong.
No, co-chairs, Representative Springer, there are about 50 custom-cut slaughterhouses that slaughter animals now, but they are not USDA inspected. Mm-hmm. There are people that process elk and deer, and you can bring your own beef cow in there. They cut it up, give it back to you, wrapped it with a not-for-sale sign on it. Yep. The one that we were dealing with in Bandon had been in that business for 25 years and looked to expand to get USDA approval and certification and then be able to sell to the public. But there are 50 of those around, yes.
I just found that absolutely amazing, and I'm not making a joke here, although you're probably all going to laugh. I think a large portion of those are in my district. Those are my neighbors. I can point out half a dozen easy within 5-10 miles of my house, and half of which we have used. So I'm thinking, wow, what's going on in the rest of the state?
Mm-hmm. I think Representative Wellington.
Thank you. And we experienced one of those, which was, I thought, a little scary. It was just kind of a trailer off the side of the road somewhere, in Portland, actually. And it's just for me, and it was, we had a deer process there, my son did. But a guy brought parts of a cow in the back of his station wagon, and it was a hot day, and they just were sitting out there. And
station wagon.
Yeah, station mm-hmm. wagon. Yeah, those old big
his
cars.
Cow.
Yeah. And, so what my question would be is, it was like a hearse. Could an operation like that call for an inspection and pay for it or whatever, so they could say we have been inspected by USDA, or is it? Can you voluntarily ask for it? Because I was a little nervous about it, and I guess that's putting a lot of blind faith into my son's choices and stuff. But we're all still alive. But I guess my point is if there are 50 of these and they're not all inspected, could they actually call for an inspection? And fast forward, maybe Oregon could set up its own inspection program, and they could get, thinking of people who might sell meat at a farmer's market or something like that. They're not a big operation.
Hold on a second. Sorry, beef or
whatever.
Or, yeah, I mean,
can't not game. I know you can't sell game, but I'm thinking beef. But
horses, if,
even a place that processes game, could they opt for an inspection so that they could assure their customers, you know, hey, our facility's been inspected?
Co-chairs, Representative Boone, I know that these establishments are inspected by the Department of Agriculture. They're not by the USDA, but we send our food safety people around to these facilities, okay, because they're processing, inspect them on some regular basis. I don't exactly know what that is because that's not my department, but they are inspected.
Okay.
And they make sure that they're as, I guess, healthy as can be. And but they're just not USDA. The USDA is there all the time when they're slaughtering that for product that goes to the public. That's what I would say.
Yeah, just to follow up, co-chairs and committee members, Don Hansen. If your question is, I have some meat that I want to be inspected so I can sell to the public, which is what I thought I heard you say.
No, not
that's a whole different
yeah,
scenario.
Not to sell, but just to, I guess, assure you that your elk is going to be treated properly.
I think that, by and large, I do that too. We have livestock, and we constantly have that arranged. And we just establish the credibility and faith in the person that's doing that custom slaughter for us, and they say, no, they're doing a good job, and the meat's clean, and I'm okay.
Lisa Hansen, for the record, but to be clear, those custom slaughter facilities are licensed by the department through the food safety program. The conundrum comes with the side of inspection to be able to do the resale, which requires federal inspection through USDA or a state equivalent program, in which Oregon does not have a state equivalent program for meat inspection.
Vice Chair Johnson.
You bring up a question, but what in regards to, let's say, jerky, whether it be elk jerky? I mean, I see people along the side of the road selling elk jerky, deer jerky, you know, venison, that sort of thing. Or, as you made reference in the farmers markets or whatever, oftentimes you see that sort of thing. Maybe it could be jerky, could be pepperoni sticks, small batches and so forth. Is there a process for inspecting that?
Lisa Hansen, for the record, if it's processed in a facility and for resale, it should be licensed for inspection through the Department of Agriculture.
So in someone's home facility that's not a recognized inspected facility, that would not be approved for sale. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Very good.
Well, you can whip up a batch of jelly in your bathtub and nobody inspect it, so why not jerk some beef and sell it on the roadside?
I knew we were going there shortly there. You got two bills for February, Representative Shoffley.
I look forward to it, Mr. Chair.
All right. Co-Chair Johnson.
Yeah,
that's another reason to be a vegan.
Thank everybody for
it. Yeah, I know.
And my apology to folks there and those of you on the committee, and especially Mr. Co-Chair, to you for my being late, since this was my agenda item that I put on the...
I've never been late, not once.
So wanted to, close a little bit on the discussion here. And I did have handed out to you a sheet of information about wild horses, and ask you to have a look at that as we consider maybe some things for the future. To start off with, I understand that there are about 50,000 wild horses in Washington, Oregon area. And the number is growing one might expect, since they're probably fairly high up on the food chain and not quite as vulnerable to some of the predators as other animals might be. The addition, and I don't know, Doctor, what you had to say on this, but the addition of abandoned horses, is probably contributing to the numbers of wild horses that we're seeing out there. And I would concur with people on the committee, as you've observed, this is probably not a very humane way for people to treat their pet horse.
that has been domesticated and then shipped off, or not shipped off, but turned loose on the prairie to survive, as you indicate, Mr. Chair, in the Disneyland sort of image. There's probably pretty rough competition out there for you know, some of these horses in that regard. Knowing a little bit about horses, not an awful lot, but a little bit about them, they, like almost all animals, have a pecking order, and your pet is going to be pretty low on their pecking order as far as acceptance into a group. One of the concerns with these abandoned animals is, you know, you've got this this lovely middle class family, both of whom have nice high tech jobs, earning somewhere in the neighborhood of $100,000 a year, and you know, with a mortgage that'll consume 100% of one of those incomes, and living in a pretty affluent, if you wish, sort of society. One of them loses their job, and the two ponies that they have for their children out there are no longer an acceptable luxury. But by the same token, it's very difficult for them to look at this you know, say that old pimp has to go to slaughter someplace, and they don't. And you know, the market dries up a little on these animals now. Because of the tightened economy, and it seems maybe to them like the easiest way is just to abandon the horse on the prairie someplace. Probably the easiest way is, you know, in these types of cases, if you can't find a market for it, is to put the horse down. And of course, when the horse gets older, you may wind up wanting to do that too. I'm told by the veterinarians in my community that it's a $500 bill for them to put the horse down. Now, you're giving up the horse because you can't afford him, and you have to come up with $500 off the top to put the horse down. You know, you've limited the options that people have here. And it was part of this reason that I brought this topic forward. And the humaneness of what we do as far as the horses are concerned, and the further we get into it and explore the issue, the more obstacles that there seem to be in relationship to this problem. Not the least of which is the federal government and their refusal to appropriate money for any kind of meat inspection, you know, for these animals, and there's very little, of course, that we can do in that arena, other than complain vociferously when we talk to Congressman Walden or somebody else. You know, they're probably right now in Washington, like there may be in Oregon, more higher priorities for people's times than, you know, worrying about this, since we're one of the lesser represented. Not that our representatives or senators are not first quality, but in terms of numbers, we have less of them and less impact in Washington. So they probably need to use their time and energy diligently. I would ask you particularly, there is a program that's being looked at and proposed at Blue Mountain Community College in conjunction with the Umatilla Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation to deal with some aspects of this issue, which may have merit and which may need. If I'm not mistaken, Representative, some consideration by the Education Committee here with a program there you know, perhaps provide, you know, some relief for it. I'm very pleased with, you know, the fact that all of you came and have testimony for us. You've enlightened us, I think, quite a bit. I'm pleased that the issue or issues we're talking about here are being recognized at the national level as well. Maybe we can, you know, be with them as we move further into the century in trying to develop programs that are both cost-effective and humane at the same time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I apologize to you especially for being late.
I was also actually here several minutes late and was quite relieved when you weren't. I must admit.
Yes. There is one bright spot in all this, and those of us who have horses or have had horses, we're no longer worried about them disappearing in the night. So I think that the theft is down, at least in my area. I don't know about yours, but
yeah. Now you got plenty of them. You can steal if you go out there and rope them someplace. You know.
We had our neighbors used one of our pastures and. They're right across the road, but it's a major highway, so they still use a trailer and all that. And we thought it'd be easier to just walk them across the road. So when you see a horse trailer pulled up alongside your gate, you're thinking, you know, they're not my horses now; they're theirs. But they asked somebody else to come and get them. But it was a little tense for a minute there.
I bet.
Okay, I think we're gonna wrap this one up. Thank you all for helping illuminate the situations developing in the country and in the state. And I'm going to Representative Springer's our friend here.
Yes.
Yeah, good. I'm going to ask Representative Springer and Brian O'Driscoll to join us. We're just going to go through the agenda, so whatever we're doing things in, but we're just going up a little bit. We're going to talk about the issue of wines made from other fruits. Wasn't honey one of them too, or mead made from honey or something? They're not just fruits. Wine's made from other stuff. Thanks. This is a technical
other than
term.
Grape. Yeah.
Other than grapes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And no. We just lost a chair. I don't wonder how that happened. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, thank you for this opportunity. This is going to be a very brief, not even update, conversation with you as a committee. Regarding the wine bill that was introduced in 11 and for various reasons was not moving forward. There were lots of wine discussions towards the waning hours of the session earlier this year. And so I was assigned to put together a work group and work on this a little bit more, which is great. I'm thrilled to do that. We have not met yet for one very practical and specific reason. Blueberry season gets in the way with talking to people about blueberries. And so I'm going to introduce Brian here in just a minute. So we are moving forward in the very near future, pulling that together. We have a framework that we're going from. Dan Jarman's also in the room if we have some broader wine discussions. But just as brief review, wineries are grapes, not other fruits. And so Brian, my constituent here, said, I would like to make wine out of blueberries, which you can do, but he says, I'd like to be able to call it a winery. And so we have some land use issues, obviously, there. This is not, and I think this might have been part of why this bill was, I think, a bit of a casualty towards the end of the session. This isn't an events conversation. I know that some may choose, and it could be taken to that, but at this point, this is not an events conversation. That is not how our conversation has been oriented. So what I think I'm going to do here in just a second is introduce Brian, have him just tell you very briefly as review how this issue came to be and what he was wanting to do with it. And then what I was simply trying to do in the bill is change the definition of a winery from grapes to fruit. And so we need to talk about that because there's different production levels. Somebody used the reference or the example that an acre of peaches, a peach orchard, certainly is not the same as an acre of grapes or blueberries or strawberries or something else. And so I'll be honest, I'm less concerned personally on how much it's going to cost somebody and what their equipment needs are to produce it. I'm interested in what they produce. And so that is where I'm coming from on this issue. So Brian, if you would just introduce yourself, please, to the committee, and then just in a couple, 3 minutes, explain how we got here.
Yes, my name is Brian O'Driscoll, and we have a blueberry farm in Lebanon on about 320-acre farm that has been in my family since the early 70s. And in 2007, we applied for and obtained a USDA value-added grant to explore the feasibility, technical and otherwise, and from a marketing perspective, of developing a blueberry wine out of a portion of our annual crop. And then a couple years after that, we gained another USDA grant, a working capital grant, to actually get some funding to start up the winery. And so we're in a position now where we have some funds that we do have to match, but nevertheless, it's helpful to have those funds to develop our winery. And one of the hurdles that we encountered was the issues to which Representative Springer alluded around land use and so forth. When we went to the county to fill out all the forms and permits and everything, we found out that they were adhering really to the letter of the law as they interpreted it, which referred to, which in their eyes made it clear, again in their eyes, that if you're not growing grapes, then there's really nothing to talk about. You can't develop a winery in an EFU zone. There was a provision by which we could solve that problem by applying for a conditional use permit through the county, which we did and which we obtained. But the bottom line, from my perspective, is that conditional use permit is very restrictive and puts us on an uneven competitive level with other wineries. And so we have a host of things that we need to conform to and do's and don'ts that other wineries just don't. And so that struck us as fundamentally unfair and not right and more expensive and all sorts of other things. And so where we're at now is hoping that this law can be changed so that we can more or less operate under the same conditions as a winery that's using grapes.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Shuffler.
So I at first, Representative, I thought it was a OLCC issue, and maybe it is. But it's a land use issue we're talking about here. Yeah, personally, I have no problem with you making wine out of your fruit. I think we should let you do it. You probably end up hiring people, put them to work. God forbid we do that. So I don't remember what the obstacle was. It's a land use issue. Is that correct?
If I could...
Yeah, please, either, whoever.
Chair,
yeah.
And Representative Shoffler, in essence, it is. It is. It is not an OL. In fact, I guess I should qualify that by saying I have not stumbled across anything that makes this an OLCC issue at all. If it is, then we've not gotten to that point, but I'm pretty confident it's not. And one of the things that happened, during session when things were winding down, and we all know that there were a couple really big wine event kind of bills going on at the same time, and so kind of overshadowed this. One of the things that we didn't have the luxury of doing as a committee, and that's why I'm here today, is I need to hear from the committee, because we didn't have that opportunity before. What are, as we move forward in this, the concerns and the issues, and Representative Shoffler, you just addressed one of them, are there OLCC issues? Certainly we're not finding that that's the case. But I want to hear from the committee, both Brian and I do, and the people coming together for this work group. What are the concerns of this committee? What issues do we need to address to bring a level of comfort, at least at this level, to move forward with this in 2012?
Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Driscoll, what is it that under the current land use criteria you can't do that you hope to be able to do? You can make wine, can you not? Or are you saying under the current language it forbids you from making any wine out of your blueberries?
Without the conditional use permit, we can't operate a winery.
And your hopes are just simply production. You're not talking about event hosting, that sort of other value-added activities.
Right, and pretty small scale production. I mean, I think ultimately, even 10 years down the road, if we started tomorrow, our production would probably be 2,000 cases a year or something like that.
I wonder if we could have Dan German come up just to maybe provide a little background from the
Wine Growers Association after we did pass House Bill 3280 in the last session, but I'm wondering...
I warned him that we might call him forward, and that's why I wanted to make sure.
Would be helpful to have him a part of this discussion.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, members of the committee. I'm Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. To answer your question, yes, he is allowed to make wine in Oregon through, I would imagine, he has an ag processing permit, which most producers of wine who aren't permitted use wineries would have something like that, or a conditional use permit from a county. I think also folks such as this gentleman are probably able to sell the wine at retail through a farm stand. That's one of the things that we've suggested for entities that don't fit the criteria of a permitted use winery to have different routes to do this. Just a historical perspective, again, it was back in 1989 when the Oregon legislature wrote the permitted use winery statute. And it happened because of a case down in Jackson County where a winery, a grape winery, was established or wanted to establish itself, and the folks in the county said, well, this is sort of new. We're not really sure you're agriculture, so we're not going to allow you to be a winery. And so the legislature, recognizing at the time that this was going to be a future ag entity in the state, established a very discreet part of the statute that allowed the establishment of wineries with some very specific criteria, such as 15 planted acres of grapes. With that comes some privileges, and this is one of the challenges, as you well know, that we face every session, is those privileges that come along with a winery. If you're a permitted use winery, you're allowed to do things such as have a tasting room. You're allowed to do events and activities about that help promote and market your wine. Mm-hmm. And so our position has been, we're very much willing to sit down and talk about these issues with Representative Springer and other members, but just carefully look at the criteria for non-grape wines to allow for those type entities to be permitted use. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that's a little different between wine grapes and products such as blueberries or pears or blackberries, which some folks are making for wine, is that there are other ways to sell those products. They can sell them at retail. You can sell those that can be processed into jams or those sort of things. Wine grapes are produced for one reason. It's a significant cost for a farmer to plant wine grapes. The cost is, I've heard numbers, $7,500 per acre. So it's a significant cash outlay to do that, especially when the return is many years down the line. It also is a significant cost every year to sort of manage that. One of the things that we're dealing with now with such a late harvest, for instance, is the migratory birds are going to show up. And last year, I think many wineries lost between 20 and 50% of their crops because of the migratory birds, because of the late harvest. So this is another cash outlay where these wine grape producers are going to have to get netting, purchase netting, and put it over their vineyards just to ensure that they don't have a significant loss. So what we have said is that for 15 acres, which is the minimum in the permitted use winery statute, that was arrived at specifically for producing wine from grapes. If we're going to look at wines that's blueberries or wines from pears or wines of blackberries or any other kind of ag products, I think a very careful look and conversation needs to happen about what is that minimum acreage to sort of align with production levels. I just sort of back of the napkin calculations, that 15 minimum acres for a winery will more or less produce, the industry standard is about 1.4 tons of grapes per acre, and you can get about 150 gallons off of a ton. So for 15 minimum acres of a winery, that's about 3,100 tons, which equates to about 1,300 cases of wine. So that is a legitimate winery operation. It's not a big business. It's a pretty small business, but it justifies a legitimate winery operation. And I think it was the statute was designed in that way to allow for a legitimate winery operation to become a permitted use winery with those privileges that I just discussed. So if we're going to talk about pears or blackberries, I think it needs to be, you need to be careful on how you align those acreage numbers with the particular agricultural product. So we're very willing to have this conversation and work with other stakeholders. It just needs to be a careful conversation because, as you well know, we've come here talking about one of the challenges is with the winery siting statute is those privileges that go along with it, the doing commercial activities, doing events, doing wine tastings, and you know, there are some commercial entities that want to become wineries for the sole purpose of doing that. Our industry doesn't support that. We think the purpose of the winery siting statute is to be a legitimate winemaking entity. So we want to make sure just that there's a balance that's created, and we're willing to work with the committee on that.
Hmm. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, if our land use laws are prohibiting you from producing and promoting your product, then there's no, that's why we're in the problem we're in, this whole country. And you know what? I don't care if he has an event on his property. I think it's a good thing. It just creates more jobs. He makes more money. And the question, I'm amazed that they asked the question, is a winemaking property agriculture or not? Of course it's agriculture. Glad we probably answered that question correctly. But why are we standing in the way? I just, for the life of me, I do not understand why we're standing in your way. It's wrong, and we need to do something about it. And I don't care if you have an event at your place. Good. Have 20 of them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Vice Chair Johnson.
To follow up to that, you know, it's not really an apples to apples or an apples to grape discussion, obviously, but as we talk about what House Bill 3280 accomplished, I think, in last session, that I think would be helpful, you know, some of the issues about the dimension of land, 15 acres in production, I think was rather than a volume issue is more about ensuring that the landowner had a vested interest or investment in that property rather than someone who just had an acre, half an acre in production, but he wanted all the benefits of having event hosting site as well. So I, from my perspective, I guess I wouldn't spend a lot of time trying to figure out the production value, how many gallons or cases you could get off of 15 acres of blueberries. I would say, from my perspective, this level of the playing field, if you've got 15 acres of ag production, you should be able to be entitled to have the same benefits of a tasting room and or any sort of events that you would choose to have, because it's not just about you, certainly. It's about everybody else. I've got apple and pear growers in the Hunter Valley who are doing the same thing. You know, these are orchardists who are looking for another way to market their crop and so forth. It's another value-added alternative. So I would say, rather than getting into minutia, trying to figure out how many acres you need for apple wine production, for pear wine, for blueberries, for everything else, I would just say leave the statute alone. Just allow these folks to come in, give them the blessing of being a winery, and let's move on. But that's me. Thanks.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And something that I think Brian would do a great job of addressing right now is because he made the comment that he's looking at maybe a couple thousand cases of wine production. But he has shared some numbers very briefly, and I want to make sure that we leave this conversation today with a comprehensive understanding of what we're talking about when we talk about production. And so, Brian, why don't you share some of the figures you shared with me as far as the pounds and the production of blueberries and what that could mean or does mean.
Thanks, and I appreciate the comments that have already surfaced. Blueberries can yield about 9 tons per acre on the upper end, so that's we're talking a huge number of, you know, approaching, you know, between 200 and 300,000 pounds is possible on that 15-acre plot. So the question of volume is far exceeds grapes, for that matter. And the other thing is, having been in farming for a long time, you can't plant 15 acres of anything that is not a huge investment. You just cannot do it. The current price of putting in blueberries is about $15,000 to $18,000 per acre. Blueberries are a 50-year crop, and so all of these things to me add up to a long-term and very, very expensive investment that may or may not ever pay back. I think that the question of, you know, wine grapes are made for one purpose only. Blueberries can be sold as blueberries. You know, this whole value-added program is about giving farmers a chance to diversify and to deal with the fact that deal with the ups and downs that are inevitably in any market that is associated with agricultural commodities. We're not looking to put all our blueberries into wine. Although, if we wanted to, I don't see why anyone would care about that or hold that against us. So it is what it appears to be. We're a farm that wants to diversify our risk and expand our markets like any other business. And that is, that's all we want to do.
Representative Boone?
Well, I just wanted to say, you know, thank you, Brian, for taking the time to come here today and talk to us about this. He's the second person in my 2 days so far here who, as an individual citizen, has a business proposal that has run up against a boundary that you can't get crossed without our help. And if we really are serious about increasing our jobs in this state and helping people be successful, and you've chosen to be a farmer, and that's cool. I get that. We have a little wheat farm in North Dakota that I don't do hands-on. But sometimes we make some money on it. And Brian's a farmer, a different kind, fruit farmer. And it's just, for me, it's seeing people that, you know, in person who we can help by helping to change our laws or adjust them if we need to allow them to be successful. And I think that's what it's all about. I mean, he's trying to be successful in his own work, but I'm sure he'll be producing some jobs in this too, because he can't do it all by himself. And the man who was here yesterday, one of my constituents, has a job or a business proposal to solve a problem that we have in the Columbia River, and it was a win-win all around. It produces jobs, it gets rid of a bad product, it provides a new resource and creates a whole new industry piece or part of that sector. So I just think it's something, I guess I'm just rambling on here, but I think that this is the kind of thing, this
that's
is one of the reasons
we're way over time, so
why we're here though, to help people. So thanks for coming.
So my perspective, I think it's certainly something that we need to talk about. I don't have an inherent problem with conditional use permits, so, because they're meant to take care of people who have specific deals when other people in a big blanket wide open use do use it to abuse things and start slapping event centers right next to the rest of us who are trying to do real farming, and they're wanting 2 acres and run weddings all day long, and they don't really want to farm. They want to take advantage of the beautiful scenery, drive up the cost of the price for those of us who want to grow food there, and then have weddings, and people are angry that I'm got spraying pesticides right near their wedding. So in this particular case, I'm not sure, you know, how it plays out, if it's the cost of the conditional use permit, if it's, you know, the county you're in and what's challenging about it. But I myself believe in them, because they're what allow neighbors to say, hey, if you're going to do weddings, you need to shut off the music at 10 p.m. because I got to be up at 4 a.m. spraying, so you can't be out there all night just because you bought a place next to me. You're now harming your neighbor's right to be here and farm. So on a basic level, I actually like the system as it is. Are there tweaks? Yeah, always. I mean, we had to do 3280, we had to do 960, we had to, you know, we need to do stuff in Big Look to remap half the crud that's miszoned that we call farmland. I mean, there's all kinds of tweaks that need to be made. So I think there's something we can do, but I wouldn't say that the you know, I wish Mike were here, but I wouldn't say that the answer is, let's not have a land use system, because most of us who farm actually like it for a reason. It protects our property. It keeps the cost down for those of us who want to farm, to not pay full residential, you know, $100,000 an acre for a lot type prices, and keeps people from, you know, deciding they move here from California and now all of a sudden I'm not allowed to use pesticides anymore and that kind of stuff. So I think it's more complicated than you really actually have to either believe in the land use system and what it does for agriculture, or you don't, I guess, is the bottom line. If you don't at all, and I don't mean on your end, I mean my friend who left, unfortunately, I think he just would think, you know, it'll just work itself out. We can all work it out among neighbors, but That's not what most growers have found. So we use the land use and permitting system to try and deal with those kind of things. And I think sometimes it's clumsy and clunky. You know, I don't really dispute that, but I'm not interested in discriminating against your product. I'm also not interested in making sure that other people who don't have your intentions, you know, don't have to go through any kind of system at all to make sure they really want to do what you do, which is grow a lot of fruit and use some of it to make a product, and instead they just want to have an acre of blueberries and run, you know, run an event center right next to you kind of deal. So I don't know if that makes any sense, but I mean, that's, I think that's sort of where some of Dan's members come from too, is we're trying to figure out how to make a big system fit small situations, and sometimes it's awkward. And usually that's what the conditional permit does. It allows a local specific review of your particular situation. And the question, I think, is how much is it costing you and how difficult is it? If it's not that big of a deal, it's probably not that hard for you to have to go through it. If it's unwieldy, expensive, time-consuming, and cost-prohibitive, then we ought to figure out, you know, how to deal with that part so you can be the entrepreneur we all want you to be, so you can create income, jobs for yourself, your family, and your neighbors. So,
I Representative Esquivel.
I got to get back to
thanks,
business
Brian.
Here.
sorry.
For the first time, my chamber did a survey, and for the first time, taxes wasn't the number one problem. The first time in the history of the Medford-Jackson County Chamber, overregulation by government was. Now that's quite a statement. I think what we have a tendency to do is we have a tendency as government to not help people achieve their goals, but maybe to figure out ways where they can achieve their goals. And I think it's a common sense issue more than anything. You don't want someone with an acre having some kind of a hoopaw next to you. I understand that. But on the other hand, the difference between blueberries and grapes is, I mean, why is that even a land use issue? I don't understand that at all. But having said that, I think what we need to do is we need to have a different attitude in government. And the attitude in government should be to help people achieve the utmost of not only their property, but them as individuals. And we seem to have lost that, and I hope we can get back to that eventually. And Sherry, I hope whatever you do, I hope it works out well, and I'm behind you.
All right, thank you for taking the time to come down. We heard a little bit about it before, but it helps to know the person and what the situation really is on the ground to move forward from here. So thank you. I know it's a busy day for you too, so thanks for coming down. Okay.
Thank you.
I bet it tastes good.
Depends on
people are discussing. They want to buy samples from you. I think is what they're what this scuttlebutt is about.
It just depends on.
Okay, so we're going to go back to our order and have our fire season update and discussion of what's been going on this summer. So Paul, Ken, Chris. I guess could all just join us if you're all here. And we're going to let Senator Thompson know now's the time if he wants to join us as well.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Paul, I've actually been out of the country most of the summer, so I haven't been as privy to the newspaper accounts, but I see the little alerts as they come in on my email still. So tell us what's been going on.
You bet. Good morning, Co-Chairs Clem and Jensen and members of the committee. I'm Paul Bell, Deputy State Forester with Oregon Department of Forestry. And with me is Ken Snell, Region 6 Aviation or Fire and Aviation Director, and Chris Worth, the Forest Supervisor for the Mount Hood National Forest. So what we thought we would kind of do here, because I know there's a lot of questions on some of the fires out there, is I'd run through just try and be really quick with a summary of what Oregon Department of Forestry's conditions and fire stats were, and then which will kind of set up, I think, these folks for good questions and conversation, if that's acceptable. Hearing no objection.
Sounds good.
The handout that's going around right now has a pretty good written summary of the season, and might encourage you just to kind of turn back to the charts starting on page 4. And I think I'll just kind of walk through those real quick, and we'll probably lay things out pretty good as to what the conditions have been, what our activities have been. Just want to say from an expenditure standpoint and the amount of resource losses for ODF protected lands, this has been a very good year so far, and hopefully this weather that we're having starts to wind down pretty quick, and we'll be in good shape. As always, weather conditions play a significant role in the outcome of the fire season, and so if you're looking at attachment A on page 4, the top of the chart shows our average temperatures since the first of the year, which I think most folks are aware of, been below average or average for most of the year until about August when they've taken an uptick, and then you can kind of look there and see that about the August time as temperatures became more on the high end of average, and with a few higher temperatures over that time. The bottom chart shows the average rainfall since the first of the year. And just real quickly, January through the middle of March, you can see the little darker area on that bottom chart shows that we were not receiving as much rainfall as we'd like to have, but things quickly changed as we moved into the springtime, and actually we're exceeding averages for rainfall basically for May, June, and in into July. And then kind of about mid-July, things settled down. We didn't receive any additional rain measurable through that time, average across the state. And we're still currently in those conditions as we look at that rainfall. If you look at page 5, which is the next set of charts, these are graphs showing energy release components for two areas of the state, and these are two areas that are most fire prone up in Northeast Oregon, and then also down in Southwest Oregon in Jackson-Josephine counties. The ERC is an index that measures moisture levels and various types of forest fuels, and indicates the potential of the intensity of a fire if you should have an ignition occur. The red line, as you look on there, the bright red line, represents the current year, what those energy release components have been doing in those areas. As that red line crosses that horizontal red line there at about 69 for Northeast Oregon, that represents the 97th percentile for the energy release components. And when it crosses that line, conditions are such that if we have ignitions, the probability is we're going to have a large fire out of that, depending upon where it's at and what the initial attack is on it. The other lines, the blue line that's darker and jigs up and down more, are what the energy release components were for last year. So you can kind of see the comparison from this year to last year, because last year was a good fire season for us too. And then the lighter top line and bottom line actually signify, you know, what the running average is for the extremes for a year. So just gives you a good feel of what those fire conditions are at that time. Now, one wild card in this is the models don't do a good job of really tracking what our live fuel moisture is. And so if you look at the weather conditions, we've had lots of rain, cool, that first part of the summer. What that ended up producing was, you know, large amounts of fine fuels that we don't historically have at that volume, as well as it's retained live moisture in the green fuels. Usually you get into that mid-July time and those live fuel moistures start to drop down and that vegetation becomes more susceptible to fire. So kind of the conditions that are set up here are, you know, we certainly have the weather conditions to have those large fires, but because of what those live fuel moistures have been doing, when those fires have started, in a lot of instances, you know, it's not off to the races with those things and blowing up. And so that's enabled us to be pretty successful in containing those fires up on ignition. I think I just, some other important factors that affect the fire season include then the volume or amount of lightning we receive, number of human-caused fires, resource drawdown due to fires on adjoining jurisdictions, and the severity of the fire season across the U.S. These situations impact the availability of suppression resources such as aviation, like helicopters and air tankers, and crews that all of the agencies share across the nation. All of these items are pretty difficult to predict with certainty or accuracy. As you look out the fire season, we're pretty good at the predicting what the big weather swings are. But when it comes to that day, is we're going to get dry lightning or not? We're pretty good about 2 days before predicting that's going to come. But we don't know if it'll be dry or not. But we take that information, and as we see those types of projections come in, we end up moving resources around the state to try and put them in front of those types of storms. An example of all these factors come into play at once in Oregon occurred in late August and early September, when the state experienced several successive days of lightning followed by two heat waves, while the southern U.S. was having extreme problems. You probably all heard about the fire in Texas burning 1,500 homes. Those type of events end up on those national resources being sucked into those areas to deal with those fires. Attachment C, speaking of lightning, shows our lightning activity towards the end of August. On the 25th, we had over 8,500 strikes in this state. If you take attachments A, B, and C and kind of were to overlay those, and then you look at what was going on nationally, like in Texas, you can see we aligned in this state almost with the perfect storm in relationship to all of those critical components coming together that could have caused us problems. From my perspective, again, one of the saving graces is, again, what those live fuel moistures were doing at that time, which they typically don't do. I would like to say, I mean, the Department of Forestry, with the cooperation of our landowners and our partners in the different jurisdictions so far this year, have been extremely successful. We've caught almost all of our fires at initial attack. We've had a couple go to extended attack, which meant another day or two in managing those resources. It is significant that none of these incidents escalated to become project-sized fire. I just think that the department was successful during this time because of the pre-planning, coordinating with resources, the federal agencies, the state of Washington, and coordinating with our rural fire departments who just provide just an immense support. The other successes in there are the use of the special purpose appropriation, which we use to have contracts in place for air tankers and helicopters, and then support and assistance from the National Guard. The National Guard's played just a key role this year in being able to provide medevac for the numbers of fires that we've had in these remote, rugged areas, as well as the heavy lift helicopters become very scarce across the nation. And we were able to work with the Guard to mobilize and bring three firefighting helicopters online, which supplemented the resources that we had. I've got fire statistics there in the report. I'm not going to run through those. Give you guys some more time for questions here. I did want to touch, the statistics are really good, so I won't read those off. But attachment D on page 7 gives a listing of what our large fire costs have. When our districts exceed their district deductibles, then they're eligible to get reimbursement out of the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund. The Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund is a source of money that all comes from landowners in relation to per acreage assessments, surcharges on improvements, and harvest tax. And that there's a chart in here that shows what funds is responsible for up to $10 million a year. And so at this point in time, and if things remain calm, you know, we may get through this season with about $3.5 million of expenditures against that fund. And so if you look on page 8 with attachment E, that just gives you, you know, some historical reference in regards to what those large fire expenditures have been. And so you can see, again, things stay really good. We may get through this season at a low impact. I think, just to summarize my comments, thanks to the favorable weather conditions, good planning, landowner support, you know, the support we get from the forest landowners in our fire protection system, I think, is just excellent. These folks work when these lightning storms come through. They'll have all other folks out in the woods doing lightning detection. That's information or resources that the state doesn't have to provide to be getting that information. And so, I mean, it's just part of the partnership that we have, our dedicated employees. And then lastly, I say just the budget support to maintain an aggressive initial attack strategy that so far, as in the past, we've been very successful with. And I just, for, I think you all know, for the Oregon Department of Forestry, the bottom line is our job is, when that fire starts, is go put it out and be done with it. And so with that, I'd be pleased to answer any questions. I think Ken has a few comments, so be happy to turn it over that way.
Hey, thank you, Paul. Good morning, Representative Quim and the committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to come and visit a short while with you. I prepared a paper. You have a copy of it there. There's a lot more in that paper than what I'm going to talk about. But I would like to just maybe hit some high points. Certainly don't have the time to get into the details, but maybe along my path of comments here that they could open up a window for a discussion. And first of all, the top of the paper talks about what we've been doing nationally and then regionally. Nationally, it's been what we would call an average fire season. A little bit heavier on the acres burned. I think you've read the newspapers about Texas and the Southwest and so forth. And nationally, we're about 1 million acres over what we'd consider a 10-year average. Within the geographic area, which I consider to be Oregon and Washington, it's been a good fire season, as Paul just mentioned. And we're about half the number of starts and acres burned this year. So it's been a good fire season here in the Northwest. It's certainly been a slow start. And the next topic I'd like to just address on is the fire policy. It's a federal fire policy, not a Forest Service fire policy that we follow. It affects the five federal agencies, which is the Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, the BIA, and the Fish and Wildlife Service. We all follow the same federal policy. It guides how we approach any particular fire. It starts, the guidance starts with a land resource management plan, which kind of breaks up the landscape into different parts. And then each plan then has an operational document that we use for guidance called the fire management plan. And tucked underneath that, then, for each part of a particular national forest, there are what we call dispatch blocks. And each dispatch block would then have, by definition, a default dispatch we would send. So in other words, some of the preseason planning. And all of our forests are expected to follow that. And Chris next will talk about that as it relates to the Dollar Fire. Many of our fires that get away on initial attack are multi-jurisdictional in nature, which we have 11 agencies that we work with. The five federal, what I just mentioned, the two states in Oregon and Washington, two fire marshals, Oregon and Washington, and the fire chiefs, Oregon and Washington. And when we have a fire that does escape initial attack, and I will just stop there for a second, we have our policy suggests or not directs that we have an aggressive initial attack. 98% of our fires that we address are put out at a very small size. It's the other 2% or less than 2% that we read about in the newspaper and we have a chance to talk about here today. So we do have a very aggressive initial attack. If you compare all the wildland agencies across the board, we're all in the neighborhood of about 98%, depending on how you want to measure that. So it is important. But when those fires do get established and do get going, they definitely turn into a multi-agency or multi-jurisdictional fire. And to help with those fires, we have what's called, it's the same across the United States and different geographic areas. It starts at Boise, the National. It's a National Interagency Coordination Center, again, with the same set of players. And then here in the Northwest, we have a, what's called the Pacific Northwest Wildland Coordinating Group. Paul and I are members of that. There are 11 members, 11 agencies that sit on that. And during the fire season, when things get active, we have bring in a small staff to help us prioritize the larger fires and set priorities in terms of what resources go where. And generally speaking, when we have a large fire, the priorities will go in terms of setting where the firefighting resources will go. Will go to those that are currently threatening infrastructure and life and property. Many times we'll take resources off of fires that are deep into the national forest, deep into wilderness areas, and pull them off in favor of a higher priority fire. This year, so far to date, we're somewhere around, these are a few days old, but around 2,400 starts here in the geographic area for all the agencies. 52 of those fires became large fires, and of those 52 fires, we're managing seven of them, what we consider to be long-term. The Dollar Fire, which Chris will talk about in a minute, is one of those. The Motherlode Fire on the same forest. The Shadow Lake Fire on the Mount Washington Wilderness area. We have one up on the Olympic National Forest that is called Big Hump Fire. It will also be managed. The National Park Service has a small complex of fires in a Crater Lake National Park they're also dealing with for the long term. And they're listed here. And to date, just to touch a minute on cost, all agencies here in the Northwest, based on the 209s that we collect data on, so it's not done yet, is in the neighborhood of about $84 million. And the Forest Service has picked up the tab of about $34 million of that. And the pictures on that paper that I gave you suggest why, and maybe it's obvious to some, others it may not, why the Forest Service is a big chunk of that. And on the bottom right-hand corner of your little handout there, it shows a BLM fire. It happens to be grass. It ran about 60,000 acres and it cost about $2.7 million to put that fire out. The Shadow Lake Fire, there halfway up on the right side, it's about 10,000 acres and it cost $12 million. And the reason that costs so much is just by looking at the pictures, you can see many of these fires are remote. They're difficult to get into. And when a fire gets established, and by that I mean it gets to be a half acre, 2 acres, 1 acre, something like that, and we drop our firefighters in there, either drop them in from a plane or a helicopter, or we hike them in, one of the things we absolutely require is for them to build a safety zone and escape routes to get out of there. And if you can imagine 150-foot trees, many of them snags, and the fire is only an acre, maybe it's an acre and a half, but they still need to have a way to get out of there. And running into the black is not something that we can do deep in the national forest. You need to have a place to get out of there. Hence, the strategies that we put in place to address those fires are we generally back up to the roads and ridges where it's safe to get into and get out of. Hence, we get into these long-term fires. The Shadow Lake Fire that you see there on that handout will be with us until the snow flies. There's many of many miles of doesn't have a hard line. It's running up into the Mount Washington Wilderness areas, and then we'll go on up in there until the snow flies. The rest of the fire where it can run out and threaten life and property and infrastructure has all been buttoned up and tucked in at the end, and that's part of the cost of doing that particular fire. And I do want to say thanks to Paul and his staff. They are a great partner to work with. They bring the landowner's interest to the table every time, every fire, every year. And with that, we appreciate that. The interests are always there, and we listen and try to address those when we can. And Paul mentioned the Black Hawk helicopters that the governor, through the governor's state of emergency declaration, allowed us to have 3 more helicopters, which was very useful. And the reason we did that is nationally we ran out, or what we call UTFs, unable to fill orders, and it was constantly happening. We asked the state, and they obliged, and we got 3 more Black Hawk helicopters to put up on on the dollar fire. That's very appreciative. And without saying, and I say this heartfelt, I'll just mention one name. His name is Andy Palmer. He was killed in Northern California a few years ago because we couldn't get him out of the woods fast enough, quite frankly, and he died in the helicopter on the way to the hospital. And I as director, I don't want to have that happen here. And working with the Oregon National Guard, we were able to put a hoist-capable ship in Salem with paramedics on board, and we had to use it one time, and we got the individual from the time of the dispatch to the time of the hospital about 60 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that kind of thing, we need to have that in place, and so it's a great big thanks to the state of Oregon. And let me just close by saying there's a big discussion around risk management, and it does inadvertently, but it does happen, and I admit it. And when we have fires that start deep in the wilderness areas, that generally are low priority fires to begin with, and we put out 98% of these things, but a few of them are low priority and they get established, and then we have to make a decision about whether or not we put a firefighter in there or not. And those fires, because we've been, as an agency, we've been putting fires out for 100 years. If you can imagine, take the Mount Hood National Forest and lay over it all the starts on that forest on over a 10 or 20 year period. Just like, take your shotgun and shoot at a map. You know all the holes that it looks like? I've seen a pattern like that. That's what the maps look like. And then ask yourself, if we hadn't put those fires out, how that natural agent of the natural agent fire in the national forest would have cleaned up and perhaps reduced the stocking and created a healthier national forest. But the society has deemed that we want to put those fires out, and we do every year at 98%. And the national forests are overstocked and unhealthy. And we would love to be able to get in there and pull some of that fiber off the landscape and use that. We do that as best as we can, And if we could do more, we would. But as you know, there's a lot of controversy about how to pull fiber off the landscape. We have a lot of work with the local communities to help that happen. But in fact, we grow fiber faster than we can move it off the landscape. Hence, then that leaves the fiber on the landscape, and then we need to address that somehow, and that becomes a risk. And when we make a decision not to put a firefighter deep in the wilderness area and move to the roads and ridges, we inadvertently transfer a risk from the federal side to the private side, because when we move the firefighters back, we're reducing the risk to those firefighters, but we also then move risk to the private side. And the Oregon Department of Forestry is always there to help us fight those fires, and we do reimburse them for all their expenses when a fire like that does occur. But what we can't do with the current laws is when a fire does leave the National Forest and it burns down a fence, burns up a pasture, burns up timber value, for example, the private landowner is left with a Tort Claim Act to file a claim and get reimbursed for whatever the losses would be. And generally speaking, the federal government will say we're not negligent, and therefore the claim is turned down many times, not every time, but in my opinion, too often. And then they're left with having to file a lawsuit and get reimbursed that way. That is the way the current federal law system is set up. And I, as an individual, there's an integrity part there for me as an individual and as an agency that needs to change at the federal level to at least maybe have an arbitrator put in place, that's my opinion, an arbitrator put in place to help answer that question quicker in terms of what obligation the federal government has to pay that private landowner. And so that's something that's down the road. I would love to have that change sometime, but it's outside of our purview. And I went through a lot there, but that kind of sets the stage for a lot of what we do on the National Forest, not only in this part of the country, but across the U.S. The dollar fire is an example of implementation of that, and I'll let Chris go through that. And I failed to introduce myself when I started, so I'll do it at the end. I'm Ken Snell, the Director for Fire, Fuels, and Aviation for Oregon, Washington, and Alaska for the U.S. Forest Service.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good morning, Co-Chair Clem and Co-Chair Jensen, and honorable members of the committee. And especially, I want to good to see Representative Johnson and Senator
Thompson. Got it. He's playing hide and seek.
Because they're both from my home district. I'm just by way of example going to just briefly go through the events surrounding the initial attack to extended attack around the Dollar Lake fire.
You just repeat your name for the record.
Chris Worth. I'm the forest supervisor for the Mount Hood National Forest. On August 26th, as part of the lightning storms that have been referred to by both Mr. Bell and Mr. Snell, the Mount Hood National Forest received approximately had approximately 22 wildfires start on that night and day as a result of the lightning storm that passed through. In addition to the 22 lightning-caused fires, there were also seven additional human-caused fires. Since we're a very popular place, the decision-making that goes into how to deal with each of those fires causes a whole chain of events between our dispatch office and each of the fire managers across the forest, as well as in consultation with the Northwest Coordinating Center tied to priorities. Specifically with the Dollar Lake fire, it was first detected on August the 27th, actually by fire personnel that were en route to another fire on the neighboring Barlow Ranger District. In the Forest Service, the local agency administrator, or the district ranger, has the delegated authority for all initial attack and small-sized fires. District Ranger Dinah Bambi of the Hood River Ranger District selected a strategy that was a limited perimeter control. Now, very briefly, let me just say, fire suppression strategies are a menu of options that the agency administrator has, from full suppression, which is building a fire line around the entire perimeter, to limited perimeter control, which may include point protection of specific assets and seeking to herd the fire this way or that, to a strategy of confinement, contain, and monitor, where field observers are put into place and assessments are done in order to check the fire spread and determine how best to do that. But the highest consideration in suppressing a wildfire is always the risk to the firefighter safety. On Saturday, August the 27th, because there was no accurate size-up available or intelligence, the district ranger decided to put field observers into place while also seeking aerial reconnaissance before deploying firefighters to take direct attack. Her actions were consistent with the dispatch logs and the Mount Hood's fire management plan for wilderness areas specifically. Based upon the weather, the information that the district ranger had at that day, and the fact that it appeared once field observers were in place, the fire was relatively small and burning within the Mount Hood wilderness, she decided to also initiate a crew of about 20 people to hike in far to the west because of the uncertainty regarding the fire, the prevailing winds, and the fire behavior. By the following day, Sunday, the 29th, the ranger had already decided to put into place extended attack with an incident commander put into place and fire crews on the wait, and pulled the trigger on smoke jumpers. Unfortunately, the jumpers were not able to jump the fire due to the fact that winds were too high. And as of Sunday evening, the fire was approximately 3 to 5 acres. The Dollar Lake fire made three significant periods of growth. The first was the night of the 29th and the morning of August 30th, where the fire went from an estimated size of 3 to 5 acres to over 800 acres burning at night. At that point, the fire had exited on the northeastern portion of the wilderness area and had burned onto national forest lands that were no longer within the wilderness. And based upon fire modeling, were projected to move north and east, threatening lands owned and managed by Hood River County, as well as potentially private lands. Given the fire size and complexity, and consistent with the authority between various federal officials in the Forest Service, at that point, because of the size and complexity of the fire, I assumed command of the fire, also requesting through the coordinating center the dispatch of a Type 2 incident management team to take up the longer duration of attack. That fire made two other significant runs, one which, of course, made the headlines, and that was on September 3rd, when, contrary to what fire managers expected, the fire made a three-mile run and grew by nearly 1,100 acres in a matter of hours. As it moved to the west, potentially threatened to come out of the wilderness on the western side as well as the northeast. The strategy that I put into place was perimeter control, full suppression on three sides of the fire, that where there's opportunity for the fire to come out of the wilderness and threaten private lands or industrial timberlands or the Bonneville Power Administration power line and, of course, the Bull Run to the far west. On the southern flank of the fire, because that portion of the fire just was creeping through the high elevations of Alpine Fir and Mountain Hemlock and would run into the rocks and the snowfields of Mount Hood, and because of the extreme danger of putting firefighters in very steep terrain with relatively low value at risk as compared to Hood River County lands and private lands, the fire there was allowed to burn into the rocks and snowfields. That roughly is a brief sketch of sort of going from initial attack to extended attack in a way that illustrates, I think, a priority setting, aggressive suppression action, though limited at first, moving to full suppression as fire behavior escalated and the values at risk threatened came into play. And with that, I'd be happy to any of us take questions.
Let's take some questions for five or so minutes. Is that
great.
Right?
Thanks. I'm in points. Another hearing. I got to get back, or my chairman's going to be all over me.
Yeah. Wouldn't want that.
She's kind of mean too. Yeah. I had the great pleasure of meeting Chris several times this year. I live in Hood River County, where the fire started, along with Representative Mark Johnson. And unfortunately for us, we're the ones that received the local calls. I got several calls that morning. I'm also a volunteer fireman, so that for 30 years, so that puts me in a little different perspective on this method. We attack house fires, and we don't have time to read the manual and go through all the exercises you have to do, because we have to put our studies show if you put a fire out within, you get to a scene within 5 minutes, you have a chance to save it. If you get there 7 or 8 minutes, your chances go down. So that's kind of why we look at fires, that you have a better chance if you put them out immediately. Just real quick, I mean, the Dollar Fire started in the wilderness area, so basically, like you were saying, that's the way you manage forests anymore, instead of cutting the timber and getting the benefits from that for our schools and every our counties and the state. This is the way, only way left we have to manage the fires, to get the bug infestations out. I know we have county timber that borders a lot of that area up there, and we have a lot of issues from the federal forest if their bug issues get to our county property. If you look at the way the whole thing is played out, they've done a great job of keeping it within the federal area. Very low impact to county, state, private property. They kept it out of the Bull Run. They didn't keep it out of our Crystal Springs watershed area. You know, we don't get quite as much TV time as Portland does when the fire would approach the Bull Run. That kind of helped us, because that got a lot of publicity. Not that that really had anything to do with the way they managed it, but they ended up with some 600-700 people there.
I think at its zenith, there were approximately 750 firefighters and support personnel.
And I got to tour the site. Rep. Johnson and I met with the governor up there. They did a great job of keeping the local folks informed. They had several hearings in the evenings up there. I attended one of them. I attended the site. I went to the headquarters at our fairgrounds. They have a great place to stage at. Did it in the end? I think it pretty well fell amongst the typical forest standard. They kept it in control. They did a great job. The only thing that I would take from this that we need to look at too is and I'm sure they go round and round with this. The basic things that they looked at when they didn't attack this fire at first, it wasn't right by residential areas. It was in pretty mountainous area, very tricky to get into, so it was hazardous for to send walking crews in there and doing that. And because we have taken roads out of service in the Forest Service area, they're unable to get to these remote areas by ground to fight fires, so we've lost that ability. The one thing I don't think they look at that they should are economics. They one of their criteria when they look at putting these fires out should be economics, because they could have had this fire out probably for $100,000 maybe if they were able to attack it with a helicopter right away. And I don't know, what was your last? I heard $9 million, but that was like a week ago. I don't know what the total cost of fighting this fire is now.
Co-chairs, as well as Senator Thompson, as of the 20th, the total cost of the fire to date was $13.2 million, with about 30% of that cost being crews and about 20% being aviation assets.
Right. And if that would have gotten into private land, county land, the cost would have been devastating to our local community. So I think at the federal level, I think they need to look at the program you talked about. The one where they reimburse private land holders, but also maybe add economics into their initial scenario when they look at fire suppression. So, thanks. I got to know Chris really well. He did a great job. He was very open to believe everything he said here, because he knows. I live in the area, I read the papers, listen, and everything he said was true, all the times and all that stuff. He did a great job of documenting that, because they have to. And their firefighting group is an amazing group. They did a great job of putting that containing and almost have a fire out. So it was nice to get to meet you, Chris. And thanks for taking your time to come down here today.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got several questions. Can I just go through them without asking for permission just in the interest of time?
Great.
Thanks, Chris, for being here. Appreciate it. And thanks for all your hard work and those efforts. I was able to tour the fire on Tuesday, and it was a very good experience. It's hard sometimes for me and for people who are residents of the valley to take an objective look at something like this, because when you grow up in the shadow of the mountain, as we call it, you have a very personal attachment to that. But the reality is that over the last 2 years now, we've lost virtually the entire north side of the Mount Hood Wilderness area. It's gone. In terms of how I've enjoyed it and my kids have enjoyed it, but my kids, my grandkids are never, and their kids will never experience that area the way I have, because it's just at that altitude and that elevation, this kind of damage doesn't go away. It takes generations to come back. But that's, I have to separate myself from that as we ask questions. But, and my question is not to point fingers or to be critical of you or anybody else, but just ask some questions. But could you briefly outline the difference between firefighting techniques in national forest land and wilderness land? Could you outline the differences for you and for your crews, what you can do in one area and what you can't do in the others?
I can address that. You want me to?
Thank you.
The federal fire policy, so it's not just Forest Service, let's start there, it's all federal lands, and it applies to all lands. Now, internally within an agency like the Forest Service, there are certain policy thresholds that we need to go over. For example, in a wilderness area, first threshold, we'd ask Chris, the forest supervisor, can we use mechanical equipment? And that can be done almost immediately, depending on where the fire is. And another more severe threshold that we have to cross as race to policy is you want to use dozers in wilderness areas. That's very seldom done. We came close to doing that up north a few years ago, but we don't do that. So all of the techniques that we have off the wilderness basically are available to us in the wilderness area. In fact, I would ask, rhetorically speaking, just take the designation of wilderness off the dollar fire. And then ask the question, given that it's off and you still have the same piece of real estate, how would we change our strategy? I would venture a guess most of the time it wouldn't change because it's in an area that's hard to get to. There isn't any infrastructure close by, and it wouldn't, on a priority board, wouldn't come directly at the higher priority. So I don't not think the wilderness gets a bum rap in terms of because it's in the wilderness, we're going to do something different. We have all the tools available to us to address those fires.
In regards to access to fighting, though, you are limited in terms of what means you can use to get equipment and or resources into areas. Is that right? Because as Senator Thompson was talking about, you're aware of that addition that was made to the wilderness area, I think, in the Senator Wyden's bill or whatever a few years ago that added a fair amount of wilderness to that area where there were, in fact, and still are, in fact, some usable road surfaces that could potentially have been available to get equipment from, say, the northeastern side to mm-hmm. the northwestern side that might have been useful. Is that correct? I mean, that's a rhetorical question, obviously, but
well,
I want to lead
that,
the witness. But, yes, there are road surfaces there that could have been used had the go-ahead been given to use them. Is that correct?
Well, I will say that the omnibus bill of 2009 added 22,000 acres or so to the Mount Hood Wilderness, bringing it to a total size of roughly 67,000 acres. In the addition, there were a number of non-conforming uses, including roads, that existed at the time of the passage of the bill.
Okay. Is in Forest Service policy, is there criteria for classifying certain wilderness areas as higher response areas than others? Meaning, could the Mount Hood National Forest have a Mount Hood Wilderness Area have a higher response designation than, say, a wilderness area out in Harney County or Malheur County?
Yes.
Based on its location, based on its approximation to some very, very sensitive areas, as we talk about Bull Run, we talk about BPA transmission lines, we talk about Hood River County private land, public lands. Is that correct?
That is correct, Representative Johnson. And, you know, I think we can always, I think, as I've agreed to with our colleagues in the Oregon Department of Forestry, that this fall we'll probably look at an after-action review formally with, between the two agencies, not only around the decisions around the initial attack, but around the plan itself that currently sort of outlines their suppression response in the Mount Hood Wilderness.
Okay.
And around the two-state area and across the country, we have small wilderness areas where we'll treat them just like commercial forest land, and we'll put them out right now because there's a lot of infrastructure close by, and they'll rate high in terms of a priority board.
So in an after-action review, it's possible that you could come to the conclusion that you may station resources in that region that could be available to more quickly respond to future occurrences. Is that correct? I'm just thinking about the availability of having a helicopter on call or having air crews that could be available to respond quicker than the response we saw to the Dollar Lake fire.
Well, the fire management plan, and if we were to review it with our colleagues mm-hmm. in ODF and the accompanying dispatch logs, would speak to the appropriate sorts of response giving various fire danger levels and the type of activities. In terms of having ships available, the forest itself does not have a helicopter at its disposal.
I could just add to that, Chris. We manage those helicopters at mediums and large at a national level. And a few years ago, when Gary Larson was a forest supervisor on the Mount Hood National Forest, the fire danger was raising to a certain point, and the Troutdale air tanker base was closed down because of some trees and stuff like that. So we actually did pre-position a helicopter Type 1, large helicopter in that area, and was used almost immediately. So we do have that ability to move it around based on the fire season. But to suggest that we're going to put a helicopter on every high priority place within the geographic area is probably limited because they're managed nationally and they're moved all the way across the country to keep the cost down. To getting to the point brought up earlier, economics is definitely in the mix. We can talk a lot about that, but it's in the mix.
I don't know if it is or not. But I guess as I talk about economics, you know, that what is the greater cost allowing a fire to get to mm-hmm. 6,000 or 7,000 acres and $13 million, or the standby cost of perhaps even a National Guard
assets.
Right.
If the governor would authorize those sort of that sort of relationship, that to me could be a preventative measure versus a reactive measure that costs more in the long term.
Yeah, that's a huge topic, and I'd love to talk to you at some time about how that all works, but do know that on a national and regional and a forest level, we look at the cost of what we, in terms of pre-suppression costs versus what the suppression costs would be, and actually those two curves can cross like this. The more we put on the shelf, the your suppression costs come down, then you add those two curves together, and there's a sweet spot. And that's a difficult place to find. And even if within the Beltway, we're working on trying to find that for the agency. But it's worked all the way down through the forest. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, I appreciate your efforts. It's great to hear about the terms of engagement. You know, I guess I wasn't quite aware of the, again, we talk about efficiencies and bureaucracies.
Amen.
But, you know, you've got multiple levels within the forest management areas that, I mean, checkoffs and so forth. It's another one of these regulatory issues that obviously it's not at our level to make that determination. It's the step above that. And I know Congressman Walden is looking at this issue very seriously, not in just regards to fire suppression, but in natural resource development on national lands. And I would really hope that we can continue this dialogue, because it's a sensitive issue now, but now may be the time to really jump in and make some changes that can really work for Oregon for the long haul. So thank you, Chris, for being here, and for all of you. Thank you very much.
Great. Representative Schaffler,
thank you,
Springer, and then
thank
we're
going
to
Mr. Chair. Thank you, gentlemen, for all you do. You know, my friend from Hood River used the word objective. The problem is we have a bunch of people managing these forests, and they're doing it subjectively, and they're a bunch of elitist trust fund babies that wouldn't know how to cut down a tree or what to do with it if they did. And they're sitting there insensitively and ignorantly in their concrete jungles, passing laws, telling these good people how to manage their property. Those 750 beautiful men and women who are out there should have been out there opening up those roads with log trucks and chainsaws and taking that fuel out of that forest before it started on fire, so those good people in the back of the room could mill Oregon lumber, not Canadian lumber. You know, it just this conversation is driving me to distraction, and we're sitting on a gold mine. In a minute, we're going to hear from some good people about, forgive me, the Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determination Act. We're sitting on a gold mine, and you guys are having out there trying to put fires out that's burning it up, right? And it comes right, wafts right into Happy Valley. I smelled the dollar fire where I live. It's just, it's absurd. And God bless Congressman Walden for trying to do something about it. This is just ridiculous. And you're the federal government, so I'm whining to you. But thank you for what you do, and take this message back. And you said it. We need to get out there and do something about that. I hope your bosses in the administration are listening. I hope they are, because they haven't listened to me for 9 years in this building. It isn't just the feds, it's in this building too. Anybody who doesn't support logging more on state lands doesn't care about this state, period. And I'm not apologizing for that one. Sick and tired of this.
Representative Springer.
Top that.
I had a couple questions, or actually a comment, and I think I'll leave it be. Way back, Ken, you made the comment about, I would characterize it as a very unfortunate policy, that once the fire goes onto private land or off forest land, folks are on their own and they can sue you and get reimbursed. You said typically before the tort claim they don't receive anything. The majority of the time when those tort claims do proceed, are they awarded fair and appropriate amounts of the value of the timber lost?
I would be speaking out of turn. I don't have the data to speak from. I just know that from my chair, from my opinion, an example, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Bridge Creek Fire on the Ochoco National Forest ran over and touched some private lands, burn some private lands. That individual, those families are in the process of suing the Forest Service because there's no other way for them to get reimbursed, because our attorneys looked to see if we followed policies and things of that nature, which we all did. Therefore, we weren't negligent. And the only way for the private individual to recoup is to mount up a lawsuit. And I can't tell you the results of all those over the years. I just don't have that information.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Thank you. That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to think of an instance where a private landowner, whether it just be mom and pop or a large timber holding, has a fire, regardless of the cause, mm-hmm. on their property. What occurs when it goes on Forest Service land?
Well, it happens regularly, and if there is a known cause, motorcycles running across the landscape, whatever it might be, there would be some action taken to try to recoup that cost from an arson fire or a person-caused fire. The Bureau of Land Management is very aggressive in that, and the Forest Service tries to follow suit. But to make your point, I think.
Just a brief follow-up, and I know that you are doing your job. I appreciate that, and I appreciate you gentlemen taking time out to be here today. It seems to be the height of hypocrisy to create a policy yourself to protect you from damages from somebody else, yet aggressively, mm-hmm. with the mounting of the federal government, go after a private landowner, mm-hmm. who could have had the fire under the same circumstances to be reimbursed from that. I don't like fires, period. I used to mm-hmm. live in Eastern Oregon. I've been so up close to them that I didn't like it,
yeah.
And it was painful and hot. That to me is just insane.
Yeah, in both cases, there's a lawsuit. But I don't believe on the federal side it's policy. I think it's in law. I haven't chased it that far, but I'd love to see it change myself.
Okay, and we've got a bunch of folks waiting to talk to us about the next one. So thank you so much for spending the time with us and answering the questions that can be answered. not everything can be handled by this committee, though it should be.
Amen.
Amen.
And the Business and Labor Committee, I would guess, is about to come next.
Right. It'd be a better world if it could be handled by this committee.
Members on this committee on the Business and Labor
Committee. Okay, so we're going to skip past the discussion of the private forest program for now and have some of our county commissioners come. And so, Tim and Doug, I know you're here somewhere, and Gil's here. Doug, can you join us? And then Ken, where's the others? Down here.
So we've been informed we have 5 minutes apiece, and so we'll just take our time.
Yeah.
Be our guests, please.
So thank you very much. I'm Tim Josie, Tillamook County Commissioner, and I'm also the steering committee chair for the National Association of County Public Lands Committee. So I'm deeply involved in the nation's counties issues as they pertain to public lands. I've got some handouts that I want to give to you that I won't speak to this one. This is just for your records. I find this very handy. It just shows the land breakdown in the state of Oregon, and so I think you might find that handy. And then the second one I'll get to if I've got time. This just talks about Tillamook County's particular problem with our county roads and how secure rural schools dovetails into that. So I'll get to that if I've got time. So the third thing is what I'm going to be speaking on, and so I'm not going to go through this line by line. I made it in a format that hopefully you can use for your records if you want some quick facts on what's going on, what the history is, and how the various counties are impacted. You can scan through this, and it's printed on both sides, and so you can get to some really quick information fast if you keep this. So this whole thing started in 1908 when Congress approved legislation that recognizes that the counties
can't afford to forego management of these federal forest lands, and because there's different, these are our lands in our counties, and the federal government is creating a federal forest on these lands, and it impacted us economically. And so they came up with what we call the contract with America's counties, where they agreed to give us 25% of the proceeds on these lands. And then the O&C lands are different in that they initially got 75% of the receipts, and then they agreed to forego a third of that, so now it's 50% of those receipts. And they agreed to voluntarily forego a third of that, so that additional 25% could be plowed back into the land for actively managing these lands. And Doug will talk more about the O&C lands. He's the resident expert. He's the chair of the O&C counties. So anyway, this worked really well for almost a century. And then the spotted owl was listed. I remember when I was running for the Oregon legislature in 1990. And this was a big deal then. And, you know, that was part of my campaign talks at that time, how bad that was going to be. I had no idea how bad it was going to be. The federal forest harvest dropped by 97%. And over time, 97% on the federal forest, if you can imagine that. Mills closed, some 26,000 timber jobs were lost. When I was the chair of the Association of Oregon Counties, I traveled around the state, talked to county commissioners from various counties, and the first thing some of these rural counties would do is take me to an abandoned mill site. Oh, they'd be just cement, that's it. And then you see these the communities, and they're drying up and blowing away, and that's what we're facing in rural Oregon today. So, and then when you look at our federal forest lands, they're overstocked, they're diseased, and as you can tell from the last presentation, prone to forest fires. The federal forest, or the U.S. Treasury, is spending billions of dollars, or millions and millions of dollars, maybe billions, on putting out forest fires on our federal forest lands. It's very poor management policy. So Wyden and some of the others in our congressional delegation recognized when all hell broke loose and the harvest dropped by 97% that they had to come up with safety net legislation that paid us in lieu of the timber receipts that we used to receive. And we called that the safety net legislation. The first one lasted for 6 years. It was designed to go away. You know, 6 years is a lot of time. We can get this thing fixed with our federal forest lands. Didn't happen. So then there was an extension for an additional 2 years, and then there was an extension for an additional 4 years, and it ratcheted down. I won't go into the details. It's here, but I won't go into the details of those three safety net pieces of legislation. But September of this year is the final year of the safety net legislation, and we're in big trouble. So now I'll just talk a little bit about the schools or the counties that are in big trouble. Oregon schools will forego $32.9 million per year. That's the schools. That's a big chunk of what you folks have to come up with when this goes away. County roads. County roads are funds from secure rural schools or safety net legislation. That comes from U.S. Forest Service, and BLM revenues go into the general funds. And so that's the reason why when you think about roads, think about U.S. Forest Service. When you think about county general funds, think about O&C or BLM revenues. So for the county road funds in the state of Oregon, we're going to forego $98.8 million per year. The county general funds will forego $111.3 million per year. So 10 counties will lose more than 20% of their annual general funds. And I'll just say that again. This is our annual general funds. Josephine County, 67%. Douglas County,
65%. Curry County, 61%. Coos County, 42%. And then Jackson and Lane are in, and Grant are in the 30% category. And so you can tell this is a big deal. When we tell you, when some of our counties tell you that we're in the process of going broke, this is proof, and you'll see why now. So Tillamook County falls into the other category. We get some ONC funds, but it's about $250,000, and we can live without it. It hurts us, but we can live without it. But our road fund really gets hurt. Now, we're not in the top 10, but we're real close. We're at 41%, so we're below Wallowa County. But look at Wheeler, Harney, Lake, Grant, Curry, Douglas, 75% to 64%. Lane County gets double hit. You know, their roads and their general fund get hit really hard. So our property tax, so what's our recourse? We don't have a recourse. Our property taxes were set by the people of Oregon, courtesy of Bill Sizemore in 1995. I was in the legislature at the time on the Revenue Committee. He had a smirk then, he still does. But our property tax rates are set. We can't fix it. So in counties, as you know, are agents of the state. If we can't provide the essential services, and I've got some of them listed, and you know what they are, if we can't provide them, you folks are going to be responsible for that. In some of these counties, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. So so as you can see, some of us are going broke. Now, let me just give you some real quick data on our federal forest lands. We have 16 million acres of federal forest lands in the Northwest. We had a harvest in 1987 of 3.8 billion board feet. In 2010, it dropped to 350 million board feet. When the spotted owl was listed and the harvest dropped, Clinton and Bruce Babbitt came to town. Remember the Clinton Forest Management Plan? Well, they said, we can't get you back up to the 3.8 billion board feet per year, but we can get you the 1.2 billion board feet per year. Well, it didn't happen. So now we have 2.9 billion board feet of new growth each year. And we have 760 million board feet of mortality each year. So this is food for thought. How do you get to 1.2 billion board feet per year? 760 million board feet would come from the annual mortality. We harvest that. 350 million board feet would come from what we're harvesting right now. 90 million board feet would be an additional harvest. That would get us there. If we did that, we would create 30,000 new jobs, and this would still only be 41% of the annual growth. Only 41% of the annual growth out there. So I'll just say a couple words about Tillamook County. Tillamook County has the distinction of having the worst roads in the state of Oregon. A company comes in and analyzes everybody's roads, and you want a pavement condition index of 70 or higher. If you've got a brand new road, it's 100. And all counties except for Oregon, or except for Tillamook County, are 70 or greater. And ODOT, they even aspire higher than that, and they should, because those are our major arterials. Our pavement condition index is 41. We have the worst roads in the state of Oregon, and it's for two reasons. One, our federal safety net dollars have been dropping over time, and then the gas tax wasn't raised until, what, a couple, 4 years ago when you folks finally raised the gas tax. None of you got diselected. The last time it was raised was when I was in the legislature, and I didn't get run out of office over that. So it was, I appreciate what you did. That has given us a marginal increase in the revenues, but not nearly enough. The last picture or slide on this shows the number of employees. In 1998, our road department had 41 employees, and we now are down to 20. And so we're at a skeleton crew, and we're just watching about a $400 million asset go down the drain. So we're in big trouble, but at least we're going to have a general fund. So I'm finished, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hicks, do you want to finish? Do you want to stop and do questions?
I'd like just a specific question to Mr. Josie, Commissioner Josie.
Call me Tim.
That's off the record. Yeah. Commissioner and I go back to my first session here when I can't say really was a mentor. That'd probably be more my fault than his. But he certainly was a source of some very good and useful information and help to me. So I want to thank you for that before I
thank you.
Throw you a curveball. And the concern I have, and believe me, I understand what you're talking about. And that's been an agenda item for me since those first days that I was here. I worked very hard to try to deal with some of these complex issues that we're dealing with. But over the period of post-Spotted Owl, there have been literally tens of millions of dollars of federal money coming into the state as quote-unquote replacement for that. How much of that money has gone to by the counties, each individual county, to economic development, to changing their economic base or adding to their economic base other type of industry, other types of jobs, et cetera, sort of thing. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, to the early days of the Spotted Owl, it was fairly apparent that this was something that was here to stay, that we were going to have to change our way of life. And one of the things that in the last few years has begun to concern me a lot is what have we done other than go back to Washington and ask them to continue, although in a diminishing amount, those payments that we've had. And I don't even know that I want an answer, Mr. Co-Chair, on that.
Do want to answer you.
If you do want to answer me, and I would appreciate it then. Thank you.
Okay, so first of all, let's. There's been a lot of efforts by a number of the counties in terms of economic development. Tillamook County has an economic development council, and we each county gets lottery dollars, and that we share with the state, and that program goes way back, and we. The lion's share of that, about $100,000 a year, the Tillamook County plows those lottery dollars into the Economic Development Council, and for the purpose of economic development, as you can imagine. So for Tillamook County, that's what we've been doing. We haven't had the excess revenues from our general fund. We didn't have the money that we could ship off to economic development because we were in the process of laying people off from our general fund. Our road fund was already in big trouble, and so we didn't have the luxury of spending additional money on economic development. But the other two points that I want to make is that we're in rural Oregon, and we don't have a nexus to the I-5 corridor. Our abilities are limited in terms of economic development. I think we all know that. And so there is no silver bullet that's going to save us. And then the final point that I want to make is there is real family jobs to be made by bringing these federal forests back. And so that's our first priorities. We have been active. I've been to D.C. three times this year working on this issue, trying to get our federal forests working again. And so that has been our primary activity, is working with our congressional delegation and to see what we can't do to break this logjam, so to speak. Okay. And I think Doug would like to answer that question.
Yeah, I want to hear from Doug and Ken before we run out of time on our friends here.
Good morning, members of the committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and visit with you. I am Doug Robertson. I am a county commissioner in Douglas County. I am president of the Association of O&C Counties. I am also vice chair of the National Forest Counties and Schools Coalition. I'm going to go quickly through three items. One, to give you some context very briefly on what is happening, to broaden a little bit on Tim's comments, which were very thorough, and I would certainly encourage you to, when you have a minute, look at that material. Secondly, what are we doing anything about this issue other than running around with our hair on fire and waving our arms? Are we trying to do something substantively to solve this? And thirdly, what's going on in Congress? Are we getting any kind of response? And is there any reason to be hopeful? Listening to Tim and listening to what you folks go through on a morning like this, you must be absolutely desperate for some good news. Maybe there's a ray of hope in what I have to share with you. First of all, as I think most of you know, 33 of our 36 counties receive some form of federal forest payments. To give you an idea of what's happened in the last 4 years relative to what Tim described as the reoccurring safety net, in 2008, $253 million came to the state of Oregon from the Secure Rural Schools Act. This year, 2011, we have $111 million. Next year, in 2012, we go on what is called a rolling average. And combined, Forest Service and BLM receipts are estimated to be $20 million. 253, 111, and 2012, $20 million. That pretty much, I think, capsulizes what the concerns are relative to continuing with basic services and the various other things that we're responsible for doing. Well, what are we doing about it? Are we making any headway on a viable effort to move forward? And I think we are. About 2 years ago, the Association of O&C Counties, which oversees the works with the BLM on the management of the O&C lands, it came to a point where it was becoming obvious that and it's been obvious for some time, as you've heard this morning, that under the current structure, the rules, the regulations, the requirements, the restrictions of the federal government, these lands can't be managed for their stated purposes. They cannot be. And the Oregon delegation has come to that realization. With the availability at the stroke of a pen to put any kind of management activity in court, it just simply can't be managed. Just to give you an idea, the BLM, in an effort perhaps to sell 100 acres of timber on a sale, their process alone, with consultation, survey, and manage, and all of the other processes they go through, can take, and generally takes between 6 and 8 years to get that sale up. And that does not take into account appeals and lawsuits.
100 acres.
That's right. The system's broken, and it's acknowledged that it's broken. So we came together and said, let's see if we can't do better than this. Let's see if we can't, those of us on the ground who deal with these issues, who know the ground and the needs of the communities, can we put a plan together that would get some momentum in Congress? Because without that, it's not going to go anywhere. We know that. So we concluded that it's going to have to do several things. First of all, the plan is going to have to give a place at the table for all stakeholders. It simply is a requirement. The environmental community is going to have to be at the table with the industry, with the elected officials, and they're going to have equal say in the management of these lands. We know that. Secondly, the plan is going to have to create jobs. It doesn't matter what you read, what you listen to, what you see on television. Everybody, economists, community leaders, politicians, the way out of this thing is to create jobs, real jobs, not public sector jobs, but jobs that create a demand, that create a product. And obviously, as we all know, wood today is a global commodity. When I first started in this business, what happened in Southern California and Arizona relative to housing is basically what drove our lumber market. That's certainly not the case today. So jobs was essential, obviously. In order to make a plan that produced something, there had to be two very specific requirements. One, the management of these lands had to come out from under the federal authority. It's broken to the extent, if it doesn't, it's not worth doing. Secondly, there had to be hard targets. There has to be outputs that are legislated. Otherwise, you have no certainty. There is no reason for wood products industries to continue to invest if they don't have some certainty in terms of access to raw material. That's just common sense. So we created a plan that calls for establishing a quasi-public trust. The trust would oversee the management of the ONC lands. I'm speaking specifically about ONC lands, not national forests. The management authority would transfer from the federal government to the trust. There would be hard targets, a minimum amount of output that would be responsible, that the trust would be responsible for, and a not-to-exceed maximum. In our proposal, it's a 500 million board feet minimum every year, and not to exceed 725 million in terms of output. There would be a legal responsibility by the Board of Trustees to meet those outputs every year. Now, given the fact that we're talking about a 2 million acre landscape, and you've all seen the checkerboard, you know what it looks like. The research and the feasibility study that we've had done involving Mason Bruce and Girard, Dr. John Gordon, Dr. John Sessions, and others clearly indicates that those outputs can be met. A lighter touch over a broader landscape. Now, I don't have time and I won't go into great detail other than that is the basics of the proposal. The lands would not leave federal ownership. They would still be federal lands. But the management authority would not be subject to NEPA or federal ESA. They would be managed as any other private lands in Oregon are managed today, with the Oregon Forest Practices Act being the absolute minimum in terms of environmental standards that would be met. In our analysis, the standards and management, road standards, that sort of thing, would exceed the Oregon Forest Practices Act. So that's a proposal that has been made. It is in legislative form, and so let me shift ahead a little bit to so what's going on in Congress? How do we get something like this through? Well, I think as Tim pointed out this morning, while your hearing was going on, there was a hearing in the House Resources Committee, chaired by Representative Hastings from State of Washington. And you'll get a synopsis of what went on in that hearing. And predictably, those folks who are opposed to forest management were there, and they're opposed to forest management, and those representing our interests and in trying to achieve some reasonable balance of management were there, and those discussions went on. And this was a discussion draft. The hearing was on a discussion draft of a bill that will be considered and come out of the House Resources Committee in the very near future. At the end of the bill, and if you haven't seen it, it's online, and you probably have it, you will see at the end of the bill there's something called Title II, and it's blank. And as was mentioned by Representative Hastings this morning, that is where the trust proposal I just described to you will be. We believe that because the ONC lands are so unique, and understand there are no ONC lands in any other state. They only exist in Western Oregon. And to the extent that the Oregon delegation can come together and recognize that these lands are unique, they are not national forests in any way, shape, or form. They are different legally, they are different historically, and they are obviously different physically. That we do have a growing consensus among our Oregon delegation that this approach is workable. And it is our hope that working with the governor, as we have been right along, and he is also very interested in this concept, that we will get a piece of legislation before not just the committee in the House, but also the Senate, and move forward with something that could be a model that could be replicated in other areas. But for now, the opportunity we have is primarily the fact that these lands don't exist anywhere else. Senator Jeff Bingaman from New Mexico, who's chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, doesn't like Senator Wyden's East Side proposal, and he doesn't like Senator Tester from Montana, who has a similar proposal on managing. And the reason he doesn't is because his concern about how that might affect national forests in New Mexico. Well, he doesn't have any ONC lands. They only exist in Oregon. And again, to the extent that we can bring the delegation together with the support of the governor, we believe that we have a chance better than any that I've seen, and I've been dealing with this issue for some time. And as miserable a condition as our economy is in, unemployment rampant and so on, in a very perverse way, that is the reason that some of the folks who have been hesitant to engage in discussions on these issues are at the table today. Representative Jensen, to elaborate a little bit more on your question, which is a very good question that we get consistently. In Douglas County, we have made, over the course of years, a concerted effort to expand our economy, understanding the vulnerability of depending on one source of income for county services. And in that effort, we've been able to bring Bayliner Boats and Alcan Cable and American Bridge Corporation and Ingram Book to Douglas County. If you take all of the property taxes that are generated in Douglas County, it's about $7 million. That doesn't even fund half of our sheriff's department. The problem is we are where we are. We can't change our geography. We happen to live in some of the most productive low elevation, high site class timber ground in the world. And if Ingram Book is still there, but American Bridge is barely there. Alcan Cable is not, and Bayliner Boats is not either. So we recognize, and I think you all do, that managing our own resources for our own needs, getting away from depending on foreign sources of energy and other resources, which then make us more dependent on borrowing money from foreign sources, is not just an environmental issue anymore. It's a national security issue. So, anyway, thank you very much for the opportunity to visit with you, and I know Ken's got some very interesting statistics for you as well.
Please, Ken.
Chairman Clem and members of the committee, I'm going to be very brief, but I did bring some paperwork to you that my name is Ken Allen. I'm the director of Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent 25,000 workers across the state, and we represent county employees in more than two-thirds of our counties. So we have a huge interest in this. I brought two pieces of paper, two maps of Oregon. One is the impact of the ONC reductions over the five-year period, and you can recognize that map because most of the ONC counties are in Western Oregon. The other map is the Forest Service cuts, and they're dramatic when you look at them. When you look at them in combination, it is very bad news and dire. We, our union, both here in Oregon and nationally, is working in coalition with the counties on this piece of legislation in Washington, D.C. We're wholeheartedly in support of trying to get the federal government to recognize this problem. But I do want to say that it is more than we need to get back to a natural resource-based economy in this state. And we, 25 years ago, we had family wage jobs in the natural resources industry in Oregon, and we had family wage jobs in the public sector in Oregon, in rural Oregon. And if we don't fix this natural resource-based job issue, we're not going to have public sector jobs in these counties either. Jim outlined our cut in the road department in Tillamook County from 40 to 20 workers. That's what's happening all over the state. Those are our members, and we care a lot about those family wage jobs. But our counties can't be healthy without a healthy resource-based economy. So we have to come to a West Side agreement like the, you know, similar to the East Side agreement. We want to be participants in helping to come to that agreement. We need to open up the forest enough to have a sustainable cut. Tim had the figures of it's clearly there and ready to cut, and we ought to make that a top priority for all parties in if we want to improve the Oregon economy. Our family wage jobs in the rural area are dependent on natural resource-based issues. I want to thank you, and I'll take any questions.
Yeah, we got about 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you guys for coming from your respective counties. I appreciate what you're doing. I think there's people cheering this math that you said it's broken. There's people out here cheering. They're saying it works. They want the industry to fail. They don't want logging in Oregon, and in turn, they want you to fail. They don't care about rural Oregon or this economy. Ken, I really want to thank you for being here. It's about time the public employee unions got up here with a loud voice and say, we want some action out there. Now, Mary's been doing her part. But where's OEA? Where's SEIU? Where's OSEA? Where are my fire brothers and sisters in the firefighters union and the state police and the sheriffs? They all should be here. They should be pounding on our door saying, get out there and take advantage of the unique, abundant resource we have in this state. It's called timber. So thank you for coming. I really appreciate it. And I don't hold out hope, sir. I'm sorry. This math does not give me hope. This is math, and it's gravity, and it's killing us.
So we have another committee 2 minutes ago trying to get in the door. Representative Escobar.
Real brief. First of all, Commissioner Roberts, why would we have a ceiling of $750 million on the proposal? Does that work in conjunction with the with the potential growth or the growth of the product itself? Because if we're only harvesting 40 or 50% of something that's growing 100%, how do we balance that if we have a cap?
The reality is that in order to get any sort of traction on these federal lands, the fairly modest ceiling that we've set was determined to be a non-starter. These lands, you're correct, these lands grow 1.2 billion feet of wood fiber every year. And the law is a sustained yield law. It says you cut what you grow. The reality, the political reality today drove us to a point where, in terms of job creation, in terms of resources for the counties, this was an acceptable level. And in terms of what has, those lands have produced over the last 20 years, it's huge. So to think that we could somehow achieve full sustained yield, we just didn't believe we could get there.
Yeah, can, is there any chance we can do it offline? Because I've literally.
We have another committee?
Yeah, in this room.
So we've been 86th?
Yeah.
Okay.
I just want to note that they're waiting for us to leave. One thing we didn't get to today, I want to both apologize and thank Peter for being here from the Private Forest Division to talk about the Private Forest Program that we dealt with through budget bill and a budget note. And the written report is here for you to look at.
Hopefully, we'll meet this afternoon in the sub, and Peter will be able to enlighten us there.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all. Thanks for coming. You bet. And committee's adjourned.